Good morning and welcome to the April 29th meeting of the Chelan County PUD Commissioners. I'd like to thank everyone for coming today and please remind everyone to silence any electronic devices that you may have with you. Today's meeting is both a study and a business session, with the study session starting at 10 o'clock this morning, and the afternoon business session starting at 1 o'clock. We welcome all public input at our meetings. We remind you that our meetings are recorded. If you wish to have any comment, please step up to the microphone, state your name and your address for the record, and limit your comments, please, to 3 minutes. So today we have all five commissioners present, with Commissioner Congdon and Commissioner Smith attending by phone, General Manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Eric Walquist, and Rebecca Garfin, Clerk of the Board. So, if you would all please join Teresa Boucher this morning in leading the Pledge of Allegiance and giving us a safety minute.
I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Teresa Boucher. I am Administrative Assistant to Generation and Transmission. I'm happy to be here today in a slightly different role than I might be sitting down, but my pleasure to talk with you today about Skin Cancer Awareness Month. So May is Skin Cancer Awareness Month, and that's only 2 days away, believe it or not. And I just think it's a great time of year to start thinking about being outside a little bit more and what we need to do to protect ourselves against something that's becoming more and more common. Believe it or not, one in five Americans will develop skin cancer in the course of a lifetime. So a person's risk for melanoma doubles if you have five or more sunburns in your lifetime. So it's just one of those things that just layers and layers of things, and whether you know it's going to hit you or not, you really don't know. And so you're exposed all the time. Every time you get a sunburn, it just kind of builds up to that. I love the sun, so I have to be careful myself. I have freckles, lots of places, and that's actually sun damage. I mean, that's what it is defined as, is sun damage. One of the biggest ways to protect yourself is to avoid tanning, period, if you can, and especially the tanning booths. People who tan indoors are 74% more likely to develop melanoma. So if you want to get that sun protection before you go on vacation, do those self-tanners. They work much better, but you still need to protect yourself even when you're out in the sun. One of the first things you can do to just protect yourself is to do a skin check and do it pretty regularly on yourself. And then if you see anything that looks odd, have somebody else, you know, take a look and then go see your doctor, who will recommend maybe a trip to the dermatologist. You can't check that stuff often enough or soon enough, so it's kind of real. My sister had it in 1999, and she saw something on her abdomen and went in, and within 3 months, you know, she had surgery and had everything removed. So, I mean, it's just something, you're your best defense. Let's see. They say there's no safe way to tan. So every time you tan, you're damaging your skin. It builds, and it just speeds up the aging process. There are different types of sunscreen. There is one type of sort of a chemical that they say you should avoid, and it's something to do with vitamin A. I'm not sure if I can pronounce these words correctly. I'm happy to send this information to you. It says avoid the sunscreen chemical oxybenzene. It's a synthetic estrogen, and it disrupts the hormone system. Try to get ones that have zinc oxide, avobenzene, or mesoryl XS. The one that's vitamin A, it just actually increases and it breaks down your skin a little bit more, so it shows that it actually works against you if it has any vitamin A in it. I also want to note that our warehouse
product. I'm sorry, it's just an amazing product that it works against you.
Yeah, I mean, it's
great. Yeah, I'm sorry for interrupting, but it's like, really? Thank you.
I want to look into that a little bit more, because when I was reading that, I'm really curious now about that too, because I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah.
Sunscreen is available in the warehouse, and I would recommend a minimum of 30 SPF. And they say you should wear it really every day, even when it's not sunny outside. It still breaks through the clouds, and we're still susceptible to it. Let's see. And one thing to remember also, mostly with kids, is that they're one of the most susceptible, of course, because they're moving fast or in and out of the water. You know, the sand, snow, concrete reflects the sun even more, and they're outside playing. So do the best you can to get them protected. Creams are always better than sprays because you actually get more on your skin versus just a whole lot being in the air. People who are more susceptible generally are people with paler skin or fair skin, blonde hairs, redheads, if you've ever been treated with skin cancer or if you have a family member who's had skin cancer. So I know that I have to be careful because my sister fell victim to that. An important part about that application is that you need to wait 30 minutes before you go in the water because otherwise it just washes right off, and that's really hard to do with kids. I know that, but it's just one of those things. Get them out of the water, sunscreen first, then lunch, then go in if you have to. That's about the only way you can get them to settle down. This is just sort of things to keep in mind and a way to think about HPI kind of in your daily life. One of those ways that it does translate into what we do every day. It sort of reflects two principles that I can think of. The first is that it's errors are reoccurring patterns, and we can do things to notice those things and to then play into building up defenses against those things that we've already noticed are out there. Whether it's affected you or somebody that you know, or it hasn't affected you at all, it's still out there and there's still that potential. So that's what I love about HPI. It's just one of those things. It's everything that we do. We don't even know it, but it's just something like this. You realize it's like, oh, yeah, that's I really should think about that. That's happening whether I know it or not. And there are things that we can do to protect ourselves, even when we're, you know, nobody's perfect. We all do make errors, but it's just a way that we can try to do what we can. Those things are available. Any other questions about that?
Well, as someone who almost had a near-death experience from skin cancer, I appreciate you bringing this forward. I had stage 4B terminal skin cancer that went into my bones and my liver, just about did me in. But and I just wanted to add that skin cancer just isn't on the top of your skin. Mine was not on the top of my skin. Mine was underneath the skin, and it was viewed as by the dermatologist as a cyst. Don't worry about it. And mine almost killed me. And so you feel a bump. It's on the top of the skin. It's below the skin. Get it checked. It's important. Nice thing about it is most skin cancers are easily operated on, taken care of. I just had 21 spots frozen a couple days ago, so I look at least presentable. I don't look like a pop mark walking down the street, but it's nothing to not take seriously.
Thank you for sharing that. That just reminds me also that actually a person's face is the most susceptible area too. So anything you can do besides even sunscreen, hats, and, you know, hats with a brim, that's actually the place where most cases of skin cancer do happen, is in the face or the head. It is the closest to the sun. I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but it just might.
For some of us, the greatest exposure.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Teresa. So, Commissioners, we have in front of us an agenda. Items on the consent agenda are subject to transfer to the regular agenda upon request of any commission member. Do I hear any such requests?
I think 14,
yes.
To the consent agenda.
Yes.
Leave 13 on the regular agenda. This, as I understand, the desire by the fellow commissioners.
Yes.
Okay. With that being said, I put that into a motion.
Okay. So there's a motion. There's a second. And it's been seconded. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. So the ayes have it. Okay.
Commissioners, we're having a technical difficulty in getting Commissioner Smith on the phone. Could we have a short break just to, because we want to make sure he is on the phone to try to clear that up?
Absolutely.
Great.
And we're going to hang up, and if you can dial us back in, we're having some technical difficulties.
Should I just wait 5 minutes, or what would you recommend?
How about 2 or 3 minutes would be fine.
14 goes to
consent. Okay.
All right, thank you.
And 13 remains as a regular agenda item.
Okay.
Steve, your microphone.
So we are back after a brief break, and Steve, I think we're at that moment in time when I would ask you to take over.
Okay. So I want to move to the District Performance Plan Quarter 1 report. Let me just summarize quickly and say the end of Quarter 1 normally should not be a significant event, and not very many things would have changed. That's more true this year. Remember last year we had cryptocurrency, and so everything was in total flux, and it was quite a significant change. This year is more normal. So we have a few things that are going on, obviously, and we'll run through those. First item is actually mine, and that is that we had a commitment to do 5 public meetings to initiate strategic planning. That is complete, and we are generally on schedule with respect to strategic planning. We're working through the topic teams, and you'll get a report today with respect to the survey results, which is something that we added for this year. And a little bit of time to digest some of those survey results that could have an impact on the schedule. We'll see. But generally, I feel like we're in pretty good shape there.
Next one is mine. Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission on page 3. It's objective 2 down on G. We've got return C&I into service by September 30th. We colored this one in the caution yellow. We've had a couple of issues with one of the turbine blades being damaged during delivery, and then some QA, QC issues with some wicket gate repairs. We are still on track for September 30th, at least as of this date of this report, but we are using up some of the float in the schedule due to those two issues. The next one, C10, follows the completion of C9, so as a result, we colored that one yellow. We can't start C10 until C9 is done, so I'm just highlighting that there. Top of page 4, got shifting downstream to Rock Island, unit B7. We've got a return to service projected date of September 30th. We colored this one yellow and caution as well. Just the last board meeting, I shared with you some of the issues, the new issues with B10, with the hub on B10. And so we are holding on B7 at the moment until we figure out what's wrong with B10 to determine whether or not we should make a correction before installing the turbine runner and B7. So that one is yellow, and the next two, B4 and B3, are yellow as well. From the same issue with B10, we are simply out of space at Powerhouse 1. And so we've got new parts coming in for B4, and as we're tearing apart B10, the floor is full, and so we've simply run out of space, and we're trying to figure out a way to get the new components come in for B4, so we are coloring that one yellow as well, just because we might have some conflicts there.
Good morning. Justin Erickson, Managing Director of District Services. I've got the next one under K5. That ensures the action item is ensure that clean energy legislation in Washington State does not discriminate against hydropower. So we've had a lot of concentrated efforts, particularly late last week and through the weekend, but at this time, for this legislative session, tax parity does not exist. And so you'll get a full legislative update a little bit later this morning. And Tracy will go into some additional detail on where we're at with that issue and others. Thank you.
Good morning, Commissioners. John Soule, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. I have the next one. That is under the NESC. It is item number one, we're marking that complete. That is a significant step. We hired a contractor who's surveying our system right now. I believe they're approximately 40% complete. This is very important to understand the NESC situation with our electric system, so then we can then partner with fiber as we look to the build-out areas and have more options around doing make-ready work.
And NESC is National Electric Safety Code work.
Thank you, Steve.
Next item is page 5, Objective 2P, Hydropower Research Institute. We have a goal this year to have a complete board with two other partners and two additional contributors and one subscriber. I colored this one caution. I'm very optimistic we can get there, but that third contributor is kind of a wild card right now out there. So it does take time when we share what the Hydropower Research Institute is all about and utilities want to join. There's just a process on their end to get the money and get the approvals. And so very optimistic, just not sure of that third contributor at this point in time. That's why I colored it yellow. And then down on the capital plans, generation and transmission at the bottom of page 5, we are running under the 80% of capital through the first quarter. Our current forecast is that we would be above the 80% by the end of the year.
I have the next one on utility services. We, too, are under the target, primarily because we came out of one of the most snowiest February, followed by the coldest March, which kind of delayed our construction a bit, but we anticipate being within budget by year end.
Hi, my name is Andrew Grissel, filling in for Greg Carrington. I have item number 5, 2P5 on page 6, and it's energy resources. Currently, our capital spending is under budget. This is due to two reasons. It's associated with the two-dam independent modeling, hydraulic modeling. Two reasons are the original estimate of what percent was capital versus O&M was off, and so there was less capital needed as far as that apportionment. And then secondly, the project came in under budget, and so those two things caused the project to total to be under the 80% capital.
Okay, I've got the next two items on the top of page 7, and they are both marked as complete. The first one relates to our contracts that are in place to meet our hatchery production targets. And we do have those contracts in place. And the next item refers to funding of the tributary component of no net impact. And we do have those funds in place, and we are working with our HCP tributary committee on the next series of projects for 2019.
Next one is the Columbia River Treaty negotiations, and we've marked that as yellow with respect to operating consistent with the regional recommendation, although the State Department says publicly that they are using that as the basis for the negotiation. We also have concerns about the way that the power group and has been engaged and whether it will be a meaningful process, although I've been told that it will not be a take it or leave it. That was our biggest concern, was that we'd expressed is that they were going to negotiate something and then tell us, here's the deal, take it or leave it. Said, no, it won't be that. So we're now trying to figure out, well, if it's not that, then how will it work? With respect to issuing the termination notice, the State Department continues to show no forward-looking interest in terms of issuing that notice, and we believe they should. I'm going to hand out an article that came out in the Vancouver Sun just last week, which I thought was telling, certainly reflects our perspective as to how the Canadians would negotiate. This was after the latest round of negotiations that was just concluded 2 weeks ago. The lead minister for the British Columbia, lead cabinet minister for the British Columbia government was quoted as saying, we're in no big rush to work on this. Which, of course, was no surprise to us, but seems to maybe have been a surprise to some of the State Department. So, anyway, kind of playing as we thought it would, and hopefully this will cause some more action at the State Department as they recognize that, that Canadians will need something to cause them to want to come to the table in a meaningful way.
Commissioners, I have the next two under Objective 5 and under the metrics. The first one is the fully loaded electric cost that's normalized per kilowatt hour. It exceeds the target by 65 cents. Couple things are driving this one. It was a high usage on the distribution side with the cold first quarter, followed by a low water year, which influenced the hydro costs that flowed through to this. I believe Craig Coons will speak a little bit more on this as part of his presentation. The second one is in the warning zone of wastewater on the cost per ERU. That really, it's such a small system. Little changes or impacts have a show up in this metric, so it's one we'll watch and monitor as we move forward.
Commissioners, Eric Walquist, I have the next one implement the governance risk and compliance modules. So this is a pilot program. We have now successfully implemented the pilot modules that we made arrangements for and have completed and sent notice of acceptance for those modules. We're actively using those modules at this point in time in the pilot programs, which is natural resources and risk. And we are continuing to make some tweaks to those to provide some working improvements that we find we might need. And we have now established a governance committee that is working to set governance policies associated with nomenclature. If this program then rolls out, we will have consistency among the working divisions and departments as to how the terminology is used and how risks are identified.
Commissioners, I have four items on page 12. Top item relates to implementation of our new bid workflow software. We did go live internally on March 27th, but we are still working through some troubleshooting items and ensuring that the program has all the functionality that we desire. And then we all are also working on an external piece so that it will also go live externally in the coming weeks. Next item. The next three items are all under the category of 5O. Which is enhance and improve physical asset protections to support compliance programs. Number one under that category is marked as complete. So we have reevaluated all of our high, medium, and low impact sites to make sure that there were no changes that were necessary. That's an annual process that we go through. Further down under three and four are two items that are marked red. These items relate to our dam assessment matrix for security and vulnerability risk. And so what we do also on an annual basis is look at those documents, look at recommendations to make security improvements under three, and then under item four, we prepare the business case and go through the budgetary process and justification process to actually implement those improvements and move forward with those. Those efforts have been somewhat delayed. We have been preparing for the WEC audit, and we also actually had some delay in implementation of the previous year's projects, which then impacted this year's. So we do anticipate major progress over the next quarter. So I look forward to updating you in 3 months on these two activities. Thank you.
Commissioners, I have the next one under R1, upgrade the customer information system within project schedule and budget. You heard the update last meeting from Mark O'Brien. We have this as a caution. Just from the fact that some of the development is taking a bit longer after we reconciled all the requirements. So we're starting to impact our testing schedule, which then has an impact on the proposed go-live date of this September, something we're very actively monitoring and managing.
Good morning. Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial Risk Officer. Turning to page 14. On implementing our mobile computing strategies. Number two, we do have a caution on implementing our roadmap milestones for two reasons. One, we are in the process of hiring a mobile program manager. Our target date was March 1st, but we're still working on that one. And then also there is a overlapping pool of resources that are also working on the CIS project. So we are deploying more of those resources to CIS. Both of those we are estimating will delay our execution of our roadmap, but we still anticipate making very good progress on this.
And I'd like to pick up on that for a second. You heard it from John. You're hearing it from Kelly. I think one of the biggest concerns is customer information system in terms of reorientation of resources within the organization right now. If
I can just jump in and say I'm actually pleased to hear your willingness to slow the process down to get it right. I think that really is the overriding key for me, is to make sure that we, when we roll this out, we roll it out and it's correct. So I'm pleased that you're taking it that way.
Great. Thank you.
Good morning, Commissioners. Lorna Klemanski, Managing Director of Human Resources, and I will direct your attention to page 15, Objective 6A3. We are putting a lot of emphasis on employee and leadership development, and we have completed this particular item, which was to collect input from past participants in our coaching program and determine whether we should continue offering that program or not. The senior team reviewed the evaluation and thought that we should continue offering it on a voluntary ad hoc basis. So that item is complete.
Morning, Commissioners. Tim Pettit on page 16 under 7A, number 1. Our incident rate, we've had 6 recordable cases in quarter 1 of 2019. 2 of these cases are filed but haven't been accepted, so that those could return to non-recordables. We're very close on our numbers there. Our rolling 12 is still affected by 2018 ongoing active cases. And one point of interest is 50% of these in 2019 have been seasonal employees. So we're going to dig into that a little further and just see what that means for us. Under 7.3, days away restricted or transferred, we've only had 1 case reported in quarter 1 of 2019 that required light duty. There have been no new time loss cases in 2019. Our light duty program does affect the DART rate, but it allows us to mitigate the lost time incident rate because we make accommodations to get people back to work early. So that's the reason for those two.
And I think with that, we're complete. Any questions from the board?
Good. This doesn't exempt. I'm sorry.
No, I just said for me it looks good.
And my question was just in terms of days away, restricted, or transferred. That's if somebody hurt their back. Maybe something like that as an example.
Come on up.
Yeah, we're able to get them back to work early rather than to have them stay at home.
Right.
There's valuable work that they're able to perform here at the district, and so it keeps our lost time incident rate down, which is good for everybody.
Thank you.
All right, so you've got that those are the kinds of events that would lead to days away, okay, and then try to get them back through light duty. Yep. Very active on that front.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, with that, we are up to agenda item 4, which is the quarterly financial review and investment report. Mark Mullins, Craig Coons will be presenting this morning.
Morning, Commissioners. Mark Mullins, Director of Planning, Risk, and Analytics, and to my right is
Craig Coons, Manager of Strategic Financial Planning.
And today we'll be co-presenting the Chelan County PUD quarter ended March 31st, 2019, our Q1 quarterly financial review. Just as a reminder, this presentation does support a number of resolutions that require quarterly reporting to the Board on compliance with our long-term financial policies, our business line financial policies, and our investment policy, as well as our board's balanced scorecard objective of maintaining strong financial stewardship. So we'll cover the Q1 financial highlights, looking at our first quarter results. We'll take a look at our 5-year look forward and our forecast, take a look at our investment report, and then we'll leave you with some key messages. This is an update only, no action required. There is additional information in the appendix, but we won't be covering that today. So I'll focus on the Q1 2019 key highlights, and then I'll turn it over to Craig, and he can get into some of the details as well as our forecast going forward. I am happy and pleased pleased to report that our bottom line results are better than budget. Our bottom line for Q1 was $38.4 million. This is $17.2 million better than budget at the end of Q1. I would like to note that we are realizing some extremely low stream flow water conditions. We have had some unplanned outages and some higher weather-driven retail load associated with that. So you'll see some of those reflections in the numbers as we get into the details. But those impacts were offset positively by our power contract revenues with our retained surplus proceeds. At the district level, our financial metrics, we are meeting our targets. We are recommending to stay the course with our strategic goals, which is reinvesting in assets and people, reducing debt, and continuing with our public power benefit program. So looking at our Q1 overview on the revenue side, our service revenue is better than budget year-to-date through Q1 by $600,000. This is primarily due to February and March being unseasonably cold. Our retail usage is up about 109%, which is driving that number. On the net wholesale revenue, we are below budget by $6.7 million. I did mention we have low stream flow conditions, some unplanned outages, and those in part translate into lower generation, where we're 83% year-to-date versus budget, and our increased retail load, as I mentioned, is 109% of budget year-to-date. So with those combining factors, we don't have as much surplus to sell into the market. On the hydro long-term contract revenue, we are better than budget by $16.3 million. This is primarily driven by retained surplus proceeds of $18.4 million. This is partially offset by lower production costs. On the operating revenue, we are better than budget by $1.8 million. Our real-time agreement, the variable component of that, we do benefit and have benefited from that by $1.2 million as the increased wholesale price volatility provide some benefits through that contract. We are forecasting our total revenues to be better than budget by $11 million at the end of the year. On the expense side, our operating expenses are below budget through Q1 at $4.7 million below, but we are expected to catch up to be about 99% through the end of the year. We do have some lagging expenditures, primarily in hydro and transmission, but as I mentioned, we will catch up. On the non-operating net expense, we are better than budget by $0.4 million, primarily to better earnings on our higher cash balances. For the year, we are expected to be below budget by $5.6 million for total net expenses at the end of the year, so better than budget there as well. So that combination of higher revenues and lower expenses, as I mentioned, we are $17.2 million better than budget with our 38.4 Q1 results for our bottom line. And at the end of the year, with our current forecast and our assumptions, we're expected to be $16 million better than budget at the end of the year, ending at $93.4 million. On the capital side, I would caveat that we are early in the year, and typically with Q1, we still have a lot of moving parts and are fine-tuning our forecast as we learn more throughout the year. Our capital expenditures overall are lagging slightly behind the planned pace, below budget by $500,000. I would mention that our primary driver for expenditures year to date is the Horan land purchase of $8.3 million of the $18.2 million spent for capital so far. Going forward, our primary drivers are Rock Island, Powerhouse 1 rehab, as well as our hydro facilities upgrade. So for the year, we're forecasted to be at $152.2 million, slightly above budget, but as I mentioned, it's early, and we're still fine-tuning some of those forecasts, and we'll continue to report to the board as those forecasts get developed. On the cash side, our positive bottom line through Q1 has increased cash investments year-to-date by $14.5 million. Total cash forecasted to be better than budget at year-end at $529.1 million. On the debt side, our debt at Q1 was $516.5 million. We are forecasted to have planned debt reductions of $41 million, partially offset by a $2 million new loan for the Peshastin wastewater upgrade, ending the year right on budget at $474.7 million. So I'll turn it over to Craig, and he can get into some of the financial highlights with respect to Q1 and our forecast going forward.
I just want to reinforce the capital budget issue. You heard Kirk's discussion of the amount of issues that are in flux at both Rocky Reach and Rock Island, and that will almost certainly have impacts on the capital budget. I just want to flag that there's an awful lot going out there, even in the last week or two, that we've got to figure out what the implications will be in terms of end-of-year capital spend.
All right. Good morning, Commissioners. As John Stoll alluded to, I'm going to talk about this metric, but I think I'm going to throw a little twist here, and I'm actually going to talk about the hydro production cost per average megawatt first, which is better than budget. This metric looks at our operating costs compared to our expectation at budget for generation. So as you can see, our year-to-date megawatt cost per megawatt is better than budget, 17.1 versus 18.7. That's because our operating costs are less than we expected year-to-date. All Rocky Reach, Rock Island, Chelan are all costs are below budget, although they're forecasted to catch up to near budget expectations. So I bring that first to allude to this, the electric delivered cost per average kilowatt is behind budget, because what influences this metric isn't our operating costs, it's actually the lower generation. So since we're producing less generation, the cost per unit increases. And that in turn is there's two effects. One, the cost per unit increases, and then we have, as Mark alluded to earlier, a significant retail load above budget expectations due to the weather. So not only is the cost higher per unit, but the cost that gets allocated is higher than we expected because we got more retail usage. So this metric showing 5.95 versus the year-to-date expectation of 5.30 is not a reflection of our costs. It's a reflection of the low water conditions and the unit outages, which in turn produce less generation, which is the influencing factor on that. And that could be seen in our power distribution costs are actually below budget, as again, our operating costs are below budget, but the expectation is they'll catch up. So if there's any questions there, I'd be happy to answer. I know that's a little complicated, but hopefully that makes sense. It's really a low water condition is influencing this.
I want to take a moment and just say I think these metrics are ones that I'd like to revisit. The original intent behind these, as I understand it, is that they help to provide a sense of how we're doing relative to budget. But since we haven't had the kind of water year that we're experiencing this year, now we're seeing this extraordinary impact from a low water year, giving a result that seems counterintuitive, that we're actually doing well relative to budget, and yet the metric is saying that we're off. I think there is value here in terms of thinking about what our hydro production cost is and what our delivered cost is, but I'm not sure you normally would want something, particularly in a board presentation, to lead you to conclusion as is there a need for action of some kind, and this isn't getting us there. So I'd like to spend some time working with our staff, just thinking some more about how we appropriately capture a metric that will help provide guidance to the board as to whether there is an action that's necessary to take. So, and come back to you at a future date on that.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Steve. Looking at our other financial metrics, the water cost per 1,000 gallons is better than budget, and our operating expenses are 95% to budget year to date, so that's pretty clear. Our wastewater cost per ERU is higher than budget, and I like to put that in context that the year-to-date operating expenses is 105% of budget, but from a context standpoint, that's $9,000. So it doesn't take a lot to move that metric a percentage or two. And then our fiber cost per active premise is better than budget, and our year-to-date operating expenses are 79%. And that's primarily driven to one contractual item that we expected to happen in March. It's going to happen in April or May. It's really a timing issue. So we expect to catch up with that expenditure. It's just literally a timing issue in regards to the contract payment.
So it makes that big a difference of $100. I'm struggling a little bit on that.
The magnitude of that contract we expected, I think it's about, I know the number. It's a $375,000 contract that we expected to have incurred. The cost to date, and it won't happen till later. So looking at year to date, we're below budget by about $400,000, and it's primarily driven by that one contract timing. So that's the metric. That's what's driving that metric.
Craig, if that contract were to have been executed in a timely manner, do you have any estimate as to where this calculation would be?
Yeah, it would be right in line with the budget expectations.
Right in line. Yeah. Thank you.
Yes. So I'm going to take a pause in just a second. So the way I like to communicate our quarterly update and our yearly forecast is we really have kind of our standard operating we've done for the Q1 to date. And then it's kind of a different view going forward because of the Microsoft contract, which began in Q2. The forecasted line items for the year will look different than the Q1 results when we look at what actually happened year to date versus how we're going to communicate the information on a go-forward basis. The service revenue will be higher for the year compared to budget because we include this off-system sell related to the Microsoft contract. And no, net wholesale revenue will be lower for the year compared to budget because we're literally transferring this this what was net wholesale revenue to now an off-system retail sell. We're still working on the best way to communicate that information internally as we learn more about the accounting and all this. I mean, we feel really comfortable about it. But this is kind of a unique item, and we're going to continue to develop reports and communication to the board to best portray the financial impacts associated with this. The bottom line is a net positive compared to the budget, this transaction, but it is really just a new way to look at things. And like I mentioned, we're still working through the new contract and how to show this presentation, and we'll improve each quarter and provide better information as we work through it. So with all that said, I'm going to talk about the 2019 bottom line results, budget to forecast. And I think it's helpful to communicate looking at the service revenue and our net wholesale revenue in aggregate, because if we look at this, we're slightly below budget. And again, as Mark mentioned earlier, it's because of the year-to-date activity, the lower generation, the higher retail load, and the impact to our net wholesale revenues. That kind of holds true for the remainder of the year on our forecasted expectations. But if you look at our service revenue, our net wholesale revenue, you see some very significant changes here. And that's really attributed to the classification of the Microsoft transaction from a wholesale revenue perspective to a retail revenue perspective. Moving forward, the only other item I would note is, again, the hydro long-term contract revenue. Again, as Mark talked about, that's really the reflection of the retained surplus proceeds we received year-to-date of about $18.4 million. We take a very conservative approach when we look at our forecast. We only forecast what we've earned to date. There's a possibility we get more in the future, but we don't want to overstate that position, and we take a very conservative approach. And every other expectation is right in line with budget expectations other than non-operating activity, and that's primarily driven to our high cash balance and our high interest earnings rate, which I'll talk to later in the presentation. So when we look at our bottom line results, the integrated electric, this is primarily driven, again, to the surplus proceeds. And our fiber, water, and wastewater are pretty much right in line with budget expectations. You know, again, fiber will catch up with that when the timing of that contract. Looking at our capital expenditures, as Mark talked about, I would just highlight year-to-date, the big driver is our internal services delta. And that's driven, again, by the Horan purchase of about $8.3 million. We had that planned kind of a little bit later in the year, so that's a big acceleration. A lot of these other items, it's early in the year. It was a cold first quarter, so the timing of the work has kind of got extended out a little bit. But for the most part, we're pretty much in line with our budget expectations and timing to catch up at year-end. And as Steve talked about, there's some things going on at Rocky Reach and Rock Island that, you know, the timing of those capital expenditures, we'll know more as the year progresses. I would point out it's noted that the fiber forecast is currently 135% of budget. That includes some additional capital planning concepts, and it's still in process. We're continuing to evaluate whether or not those will happen, but it assists the entire fiber network group in regards to their strategic planning and what they're thinking about to provide the best information for planning purposes. We would never, we're not sure, but we would always go to the board if that plan is actually going to be enacted. Looking at our overview for year-to-date cash flow, bottom line results are about $38 million year-to-date. We add back the non-cash expense of $11 million of depreciation. So we basically received cash from operations of about $49 million. We've used $18 million for our capital projects. And then this other miscellaneous ARAP, to be clear, that's really paying down our accounts payable. We had about $55 million of accounts payable at year end. It's now at about $37 million at March. So at the end of the year, we do a fantastic job of accruing all of our expenditures we expect to earn, and our payables get, and then we pay them down. So we use a lot of cash to pay down our payables back from year-end balance. And then we added $15 million to cash reserve, which gets us to that $49 million. So at the beginning of the year, we were at $591 million. We added the $15 million in cash and investments. Then at Q1, is $606 million. And looking how that's broken up, at the end of the quarter, we had $353 million of unrestricted funds. We still keep our $50 million for our headquarters service center strategic facilities fund of $50 million. I would note that this restricted funds for hydro and capital debt increased from $50 to $112 million. That was due to that was presented to the board a while back, the internal loan we gave to Rock Island for our capital investments. So that money basically got moved from an unrestricted fund to a restricted fund for capital investments. It doesn't affect our liquidity because that is treated as liquidity, but it does affect our unrestricted cash, which does have an impact to our day's cash on hand, which I'll talk later. But it was really a timing issue. Now I'll be clear about that later. And then looking at our restricted funds, they're pretty much consistent with what we've been saying at year end, other than the power contract deposits. As we enter into more contracts, we get collateral deposits. And then we can look at our $591 million balance at year end versus our $606 million balance at Q1. Looking at our quarterly reporting requirements, as Mark mentioned, we're meeting all of our financial metrics, and they've actually improved since Q1. I would note that consistent with Q4, we are still forecasting to go to the market to maintain liquidity in 2022 and 2023. But I would note the amount that we're going out to maintain liquidity has dropped due to our good year we're forecasting for this year. The debt ratio, again, our target was to be below 35% in 2019. We met that in 2018, and we're forecasting to be at 30.3 in 2019. The day's cash on hand, I just want to talk this briefly because that's a little bit different than what we were saying at Q4. it dropped because of that transfer from the unrestricted for the Rock Island internal loan, but it gets back to where we thought it would be in 2020. It was literally a timing. We were looking at two years of loaning, kind of a real-time modeling, versus accelerating that. So everything's right where we expect it to be. Our combined debt cover remains relatively, actually really strong at 3.13, and our rate of return is at $7.4 million. So looking at our bottom line results for 2019, we're looking at $93 million, and our debt outstanding at $475 million. And so I alluded to the 2022 and 2023 timeframe, and I just want to quote these numbers since I have them handy. I mentioned we're looking better than we thought at Q4, just to put it in context, we were forecasting to have debt outstanding of $381 million in 2022, and under unusual was $407. So things have improved, and they've rippled through that forecast. These are highlighted in yellow just because they're within 10% of our policy metric. Looking at our individual quarterly business line reports, these are pretty much consistent with what we were showing at Q4. Nothing has materially changed. Some of these are lying outside of our targets. Some are within 10%. We continue to work on this during strategic plan and coming up with corrective actions to address these issues. Now, this is our integrated electric approach, and quite honestly, I just wanted to be very clear. These are test metrics, and we're reevaluating these metrics as we study the impact of that off-system sell. Having such a significant increase to our retail position is causing some opportunities for us to reevaluate these. As you know, when you literally add the numbers we're talking about from wholesale to retail, these numbers may not be telling us what we want them to tell us. So we're going to continue to reevaluate these and come up with metrics that are best suited for the current world we're living in going forward.
You could probably tell last week we were looking at some results and realizing how this Microsoft sale was floating through to some of these more detailed metrics, and it didn't appear to be producing useful results. And so it caused us to think we need to just go back and rethink this whole question about how we characterize the sale and retail versus wholesale, how that flows through to all of our metrics, and just make sure that we've got it in a fashion that it's producing usable results that we can actually act upon. And at this point, we're not there with respect to these metrics. We don't need to do something on this immediately. We will ultimately want to address this as part of the output from the topic team and part of strategic planning to think about where we go with rates, so we have some time to be able to integrate and make sure that we're creating the right picture of what's going on inside the business.
Thank you, Steve. In the quarterly investment report, as I alluded to earlier, we budgeted an earnings rate of about 2.41%, and our current district yield year-to-date is 2.52, so it's improved. This is a change from Q4 when, and that's driven primarily to, you know, the weighted average of maturity. We have longer-term maturity of 947 days compared to like a three-month T-bill. So when we were in that high interest environment where the Fed was keep bumping up the interest rates, it's hard for us to catch up with that. Conversely, if it was the opposite, it would be better for us, so we wouldn't be impacted in a lower environment. But we are exceeding our budget expectations due to our higher cash balance and the higher interest rates. And we're meeting all of our policy objectives and all of our clients' compliance metrics. So the key one messages I'd like to leave you with is our early forecasts are much better than budget. And Q1 has really been influenced. The results have been influenced by our contracts, the low stream flow conditions and unit outages, and a lot of higher weather-driven retail load. But when we look at the forecast, everything looks really good as meeting our expectations in regards to costs. You know, these are things we really can't control in regards to the low water conditions. We manage to them, but what can we, you know, the water is what the water will be. The long-term financial metrics policies are right on track, and we recommend staying the course with our strategic goals. And I guess the key takeaway would be stay tuned for more information on our off-system sales in our Q2 financial report. As we develop better presentation ability and communication, it'll be something you can look forward to. And as always, there's a lot of information in the appendix, which we won't cover. And I would highlight that the forecast results will show the off-system retail sales impacts in our forecast for the next 5 years. It's a five-year contract, and those are reflected in those.
Are there any questions from the Q1 update?
Commissioners, any questions?
No. Just pretty happy where we are. Thank you to everybody, and it's a good space to be.
Great. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay, next up, we want to talk about a legislative update. We've got a team that was working all the way until who knows what hour last night, and here to provide you a summary of what the legislature has done now that it has concluded its work.
Good morning. Tracy Hunt, Director of External Affairs.
Sean Seaman with External Affairs.
We were told it was going to be a 105-day session. It actually turned out to be a 3,000-day session. I don't know. Felt like it. So we do have some highlights for you. And there you go. We're going to cover some good news with some bid limits. Have a couple of transportation bills, where we ended up with broadband, hydro tax parity, a lot of effort towards the end of the session on that, wildfire, a couple items on there, and then low carbon fuel standard. And then do want to wrap in a clean energy standard, a comment on some recent comments we have there. No action today. So bid limits, this is a good news story that covers a number of groups in the district, but Eric has highlighted in an email his pleasure with where this ended up, so he was going to highlight a couple of those to share what all of us did, and utilities, Sean, especially for the PUD, getting some changes to the PUD bid limits.
Yeah, Commissioners, thanks. I just wanted to express my thanks and appreciation to Sean, particularly, and the rest of the team working on this legislative effort. I think this is outstanding news for the district. A lot of the way we procure goods and services are controlled by the legislative procedures and process that we, like other public entities, are bound to follow. And sometimes that can mean, at relatively low dollar amounts, considerable effort and resulting delay in that. So, it's always a pleasure to see an increase in those limits. Some of the more specific ones here I think that will be very valuable to the district is the purchase of materials, equipment and supplies, those things that I call stuff in my contract training. Those limits for procurement without a formal process for competitive selection have increased from $15,000 to $30,000. The same is true for work or labor. That threshold actually only 10 years ago or so was $10,000 without a formal competitive process, and that increased to $25,000 and now has gone to $50,000, which is going to be super beneficial for the district to move things along. Some other minor changes I would think are less impactful to the district but still help. Small works process limits go from $300,000 to $350,000. The ability to do work with our own personnel has increased from $150,000 to $300,000 worth of materials and supplies, which is an important caveat. What that really means in shorthand is that our folks can go out and complete projects and do work as long as what I call the consumables, the materials and supplies necessary to do that work, don't total up to more than $150,000, now $300,000. That next piece, which is joyful in my heart, is that that number excludes equipment from that calculation. So those things that are pieces of equipment with a specific purpose related to that particular project are excluded from that threshold. And I'm happy to say that this legislation now exempts as equipment those things that you see on the screen, like conductor and cabling, both electric, telecom, et cetera, which is near and dear to my heart because this is an issue that I've been working on for 20 years. So that's an awesome and exceptional piece of legislation in favor of the districts and will help us, I think, move projects along at a faster clip for those that are below these thresholds. Now, it also creates work for some of us because we have to go back and pull up all of the resolutions that we have related to these alternative procurement methodologies that the board has issued in the past and make sure that we were as smart as we thought we were back in the day when we wrote those and we referenced the legislation specifically as a particular, or as opposed to the specific dollar amount. So it could be that you will see resolutions coming back to you where probably some lawyer, me, put in a number that was the threshold in the statute at the time instead of allowing for natural increases in those. So don't yet know the outcome of that and whether I was as smart as I thought I was or if I'll be back to you asking you to make those changes. But this is a big win, I think, for procurement for the district, particularly given our workload and what we're trying to accomplish for the benefit of the customer owners. So
I would like to say, as we try to increase our program from the $30 million year capital to the currently budgeted $150 million, these kinds of things really help because we're struggling with process and how we manage through process. So I want to reinforce Eric's message. This will be very helpful to us. And also want to call out that Waputo was really big on this. And So I know that you guys are very active in Waputo. So thanks to the commissioners. Waputo's leadership on this was very important in terms of being able to create a statewide initiative and then to bring in other players as well that help to expand the activity that would be covered by this piece of legislation.
So one other thing I'd add to that, commissioners, that I'd forgotten until Steve's comments, is that it really does illustrate how Waputo and the PUDs are out there working for the benefit not only of our own PUDs and the association, but for other municipals. You'll recall several years ago when we were engaged with the auditor about a discussion on unit price contracting, and we were successful in getting a carve-out piece of legislation for PUDs that enabled us to go out and set these unit price contracts up so that we, when we knew we had work we'd be doing piecemeal throughout the year, we could set within parameters in legislation those contracts up so that we could take advantage of them without the immediate delay at the time of procuring them because we thought in advance and procured them. So this actual legislation also added that provision for a number of other municipals, including counties and special purpose districts. Another illustrative example of how the PUDs and the association are outworking to advance the procurement proposition.
All right. Thanks, Eric. Steve?
This is Ann. Excuse me. Just a congratulations to Eric and Tracy and Sean. This sounds like this is a big win for us, for a lot of the PUDs. So good work. Congratulations.
Thank you, Commissioner, although Eric probably isn't deserving in that list.
You approved what we were doing, though, Eric, so thank you for that.
That was easy. You were asking for everything we wanted.
John, it seemed like, to me, one of the questions that was coming up at one point, there wasn't a question of whether this was good for us, but what would be the impact on other agencies that if they were just, I got this feeling they were a little stunned, and what does this mean to them? That apparently, without moving forward, there wasn't any negative reaction?
No, Commissioner, the only negative reaction we were getting at some point was from the groups representing different contractors, but even they ended up buying off and accepting, seeing that there's some value in this. So at the end of the day, this became a large omnibus bill. There were a bunch of separate ones, and the legislator said, this is crazy, let's put them all together, and that's what we have. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't hear anything, because I think all these other agencies, local government, all saw the benefit from what they were getting as well.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right, we wanted to dig a little bit into that one more than the rest of these. Potentially, wanted to highlight some of the benefits there. So, Sean?
Yeah, we'll quickly get through what's gone in transportation. This first bill, 1512, this is the same bill that's been in play for at least 3 years now. This is the third year. This was just a bill to give clearer authority. We thought we had the authority, but some other utilities, public utilities, wanted clearer an explicit authority to offer electric vehicle programs. So if you remember what that program was, that's what this bill does, and now it's in place. And in addition to that, so this would allow us to offer programs very explicitly. The Green Transportation Program that was also pushed through late last night, there were many things that got pushed through late last night, and I looked at the feed at 11 or 12 o'clock at night, we're seeing things come through. This one, though, expanded the ability for the state to offer and extend, in this case, sales and use tax exemptions for a purchase of new and used electric vehicles, a little break on those taxes. There's a certain value to those. There's limits. It allows some grant dollars for EV charging infrastructure throughout the state, including whether it be for a corridor, I-5 or 990 type of corridor infrastructure, could be for PUDs as well. We can take advantage of. And again, this is tax break or B&O tax or other sales and use tax exemptions. So not big dollars, but it's trying to incentivize some growth of these systems. There's going to be grant programs for transit, so Link should be looking at this carefully because there could be some opportunities there. And it's going to be funded mainly through some increased fees in electric vehicle licensing, increasing those from current dollars, I think about $150, $200, another $100 a year for those. And then some credits against B&O tax and public utility taxes. A lot of moving pieces to this for us. It would be infrastructure we wanted to, but potentially growth in EVs will continue to go forward in the state because of the particular bill, 2042. The broadband bill, I think you're all quite familiar with this. It's been a subject at WAPUTA at least since before the first of the year and then throughout each meeting. The bottom line for us is that the bill did finally pass. It was a Senate version, of course. It was competing 1498 in the House. They both stayed together late into the session. It establishes the state band office. I'm digging through the budget to see how much money they eventually earmarked for this. I haven't found that yet. They did allocate money for implementing the office, $264,000. But for us, it provided the safe harbor provision. We ended up with the total of 6 months at the end of the day. Had the 11 months in, and it was out and in and out, and at the end of the day, it was the 6 months. Anything on that?
So moving on to the hydro tax parity, and this is the bill that led to the performance plan Q1 item, tax parity does not exist, being yellow from the prior report. This was the one thing that we were pushing for, in addition to a lot of good things that did happen. Clean energy standard did pass this year, and it did include hydropower as a renewable resource, so that was a very positive aspect. But to get the trifecta, to get everything we wanted, the reason this is yellow on the report card is because we did not get the hydro tax parity, and it wasn't for lack of trying. A lot of work went into that. In the end, the Nature Conservancy, IBEW, a number of public utilities, Avista, all joined together, and I'm sure I'm forgetting one or two more, with a great amount of work. So we are set up well for the interim. and this will be a subject for the next legislative session.
And I want to thank Senator Hawkins, who really did an extraordinary job here in terms of the level of effort that he put into this. And you know, disappointed we didn't get there, but it certainly wasn't for lack of trying.
I would concur with that.
Wildfire legislation wanted you to be aware that there was a insurance premium tax increase that was proposed to help fund the Department of Natural Resources that had two main components. One was wildfire prevention. The other was wildfire fighting. Up until late last night, a lot of discussions going on, but that bill did not pass, did not proceed out of the Senate. So I'm sure that that will be a an item that will be discussed over the interim and into next year. There was the Utility Wildland Fire Task Force creation, though. Senate Bill 5305, utilities will be working with the state to identify opportunities, including working with Department of Natural Resources. That did pass.
So the low carbon fuel standard, as you recall, this is one that would have basically put a tax on various fuels with some exemptions, and it would have created a market for credits where groups like the PD could have participated in, but it would have increased fuel costs for across the state. This bill did not make it. There were various efforts, various amendments, striking amendments to do such a thing, but it did not make it at the end of the day. We're coming back to the 5116, the Clean Energy Standard, not to go over the bill itself, but to highlight one of the sections that we're going to be focusing on as a utility. And we've heard from a couple of the topic team partners on this issue, and that's Section 12, which addresses low-income energy assistance programs. There's a lot to be determined on this. We've reached out to Commerce, who will be leading the rulemaking efforts to implement this. And the basic response is, thanks for a heads up. You're right. We got a lot of work to do on this. Basically, this isn't about incremental costs of the clean energy plan, but it's actually to take a look at the total energy burden of the residents of Washington State and seek help from utilities to help reduce that burden, particularly those who identified as low-income customers. We've got a lot of programs in place right now. We were successful in adding language into that or changing language in the bill that was more reflective of things utilities are doing. But this is a considerable, let's wait and see what's going to happen. I feel that with the work that we do at the Chelan PUD is we do quite a bit. We'll see what comes out of the process with Commerce and will we be asked or should we consider doing more. So more of that, much more on that later. I guess a couple things in closing. From my perspective, one thing we didn't have on here that we have been talking about, is the capital budget included $30 million for the Centennial Clean Water Grant Fund, which we're looking for Shasta, and that's in place. So those dollars have been accepted or approved. The other issue we have is just a matter. This is my list of bills. I have 5 pages of bills, almost 50 bills that now I have to work with Melinda. How do we get the information out? These are bills that pass that either directly impact the district or have something we need to know about in the future. And this is, for me, unprecedented. I mean, we may see 20, 25 bills that are really that have this scope. This is almost 50 this year. Mm. It was a significant year from a legislative standpoint. And one of the things that we heard is that they passed a revenue package last night that was pretty significant. So it was needed to fund all this package. Part of it was another $2.2 billion, if I have the numbers right, in tax increases, mainly B&O tax increases. And so that generally has implication for the legislature in the future. So remains to be seen what this size of revenue package will do going forward. What I hope it means is next year a short session is truly a lot easier. Truly.
So there's a lot that goes into a legislative session, as we all know. We have a team in Olympia, Matt Stewart-Walt, Dave Arbaugh. We have the PUD Association. Mm-hmm. But I want to call out Sean Seaman on this session. He did a great job. We got a lot of stuff done. The PUD benefited largely because of what Sean did in Olympia. At the last minute, changed his plans to go back over again last week, trying to help where he could with the tax parity bill. Never shied away from getting to Olympia, working with folks, working with our delegation. And I think a lot of the success that the PUD got this year was because of the work Sean did.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Just to echo that, it would have been some of us who got calls and emails from Sean at all hours of the day and night, but she was less effective.
Well, I see Andrew smiling about that because I hit him a number of times on weekends or whenever. So thank you all for the support. And I will add, if I may, Tracy put in a system of the liaisons, external affair liaisons throughout the district. So I know who I need to talk to. And without exception, very responsive. Dave Arbaugh brought up an issue late one afternoon about this tax revenue bill. And I said, I have no idea. Sent it to Amy, and Amy Smith. She got back to us within minutes, and within an hour had an answer on the impact. Fortunately, it's a small impact to the district, but we had no idea there would be any impact. But Amy is right there, and I can say it about many people throughout the district. But without their help, we wouldn't have the results that we're having. So thank you to everybody in the district as well.
Yeah. Thanks to you, and thanks to the team.
Yeah. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, next up, we want to give you some survey results. We're going to invite Susan Gillen and our friends from Cocker Fennessy to join us to talk about the public opinion survey that was recently completed with results with respect to aesthetics and growth in particular.
So good morning. I'm Susan Gillen from Customer Energy Solutions, and this is Vanessa Lynn, and with her today is Kyle Jensen from Cocker Fennessy in Seattle. The senior team gave me direction to work with Cocker Fennessy on developing a customer survey that looked at our customers' perspectives on our infrastructure aesthetics and also the PUD's role in economic development. So we started working together, I believe, in January, and the survey took place in March. And Vanessa is here today to share those results with you. So, Vanessa.
Thank you. Thank you. It really is a privilege to be able to come here today and present these findings, and I've so enjoyed working with your team. It's really been a very interesting experience, and they've kept things very focused, which we appreciate. Let me give you a little bit of background about what we were trying to accomplish with this research, and then we'll dig into the findings. So we were brought on to work on this effort because of an interest in better understanding customers' opinions and perspectives, particularly with regard to infrastructure aesthetics and approaches to economic development. So there were some key questions that staff were asking, things like, well, are those who are critical of above-ground power lines representative of our customers overall, or is this a segment of our customer population? We wanted to know things like, do people value the utility's low rates and see that as economic development, or are they looking for something else, like a more proactive role? And for those who do want to see changes in PUD policies, do they want changes and are willing to pay for it, or is it, I like it if everything could still stay the same? So staff certainly had some theories about how people felt and how this would fall out, and that's what research helps us do, is it helps us test some of those hypotheses. So we wanted to get out into the community and find out scientifically what customers' perspectives were. So we conducted a scientific survey of your customers. We talked to 600 people, so that's the sample size, and we relied on your customer list for the sample. We used what we call a mixed methodology, so we did a combination of online and phone surveys. And I won't go into a whole spiel about survey techniques unless you want one later, increasingly, it is becoming difficult to do phone surveys. Fewer people have landlines, and cell phones, there are issues with safety, certainly, in calling and asking people survey questions. And frankly, people screen their calls, and I can't imagine why, but sometimes they don't want to answer surveys. So phone surveys are hard to do. Online, though, is becoming easier to do and, frankly, more scientific. And so we did a mix of both because based on your sample, we didn't have emails for every single customer, so we felt that we needed to do this blended approach to reach people. So I mentioned how wonderful and focused the staff were here in designing the survey. You know, people had lots of questions, but they recognized that no one wants to answer a 20-minute survey. And so we really honed in on the key questions and kept things relatively brief at 8 to 10 minutes. We did do the survey in English and Spanish. And Susan mentioned we fielded this in March. We do a little bit of adjustment after we field the survey to correct for any over-response based on age and gender, and we weighted the two county data. So let me first highlight some key findings, and then I'm going to go into detail on these in subsequent slides. So first of all, I want to say that the familiarity with the PUD is really quite strong. So 97% are at least somewhat familiar with the PUD, and 60% are strongly familiar, which was really good kind of going into the survey. We tested a few things that people might value most about the PUD, and it was clear that your affordable rates were very highly valued. I mentioned that some people hypothesized before we surveyed. A minority of your customers are concerned about aesthetics. We did look at who was most concerned, and those with second homes were among the most likely to be concerned about this. A majority believe that only those who directly benefit from power line conversions should have to pay for it. And on average, customers were willing to spend about $2 to $4 a month for something that we called an aesthetic improvement fund.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
When you say few, a third of those who responded is what's considered few? I mean, where do you come up with a terminology of what's significant and when is the number a few?
Does 33% not sound like few?
Well, a third.
Not a majority.
Yeah.
A third.
Yeah. I'm just curious. A third sounds significant to me, but I guess
that's a good point. I think people may see this different ways. Yeah. We were looking at where a majority of people had a concern, and we will actually go into a little bit more about the distribution of that, but I think that's a good question about whether that few is an accurate way to describe 33%. So those were some of the aesthetic questions. On economic development, 28% were strongly familiar with the PUD's role when it came to economic development. But what's interesting is once we started testing some statements about economic development, we saw that customers overwhelmingly believed that the PUD should keep rates low to attract jobs and investment in the community. A majority, and this is another, you know, wordsmith, is it slim or not? A slim majority, we're calling it, support making investments in infrastructure ahead of need, even if it increases rates. The average amount that people were willing to spend for this, for paying in advance of infrastructure need, is $2 a month. And at the end of the survey, we did ask people about their to prioritize things again. This was similar to the value statement at the beginning. And people, again, said affordability was really important, but reliability was also up there. So this gives you kind of the overall landscape of what we learned from the survey. And I'd like to go into a little bit more detail on these now. So here's our familiarity statement, and it's interesting because we had quite a lively discussion about, you know, what's good or bad here, right? So what's the familiarity with the PUD? We just wanted a sense of, we're calling people and we're surveying them online. Do they know what the PUD is? Did they feel some connection, familiarity? 60% we would call strongly familiar. But overall, 97% at least were somewhat familiar with the PUD, with only 2% not at all familiar. And I do keep in mind, they are all your customers.
Excuse me, can I ask a question? Because that was somewhat puzzling to me.
Why are 2% saying?
If you're working off a list, that the PUD provided, the assumption is that these are PUD customers.
That's right.
So what would be
why
the reason
would someone
why
not
familiar, right?
Because if someone else in my household is the one who pays the bills, who knows the name of who of the utility provider, it could be one of those folks. There was a strong relationship between those who were in the region longer. So people who were in the region longer tended to be more familiar with the PUD, which I think you would pretty much expect. We also looked at whether Chelan County was their primary residence or not. And so people who were primarily lived here were more likely to be strongly familiar with the PUD.
Question on the phone.
Hello. Yes.
Good, Randy.
Hi. Yes. That number that you're looking at there of 65% of people being this being their primary residence, does that align with what you know? And maybe you can't get that answer today, and it might be our staff. Does that align with how the breakout of our meters in Chelan County? 35% live outside of the county.
Well, let me just clarify. So that the data in that block, so those are, so people whose primary residence is Chelan County, 65% of them said they're familiar or very familiar with the PUD. So the actual percentage of people who, I have it elsewhere in my data set. So that's not just the people who.
Okay, I gotcha.
And we did have some discussion about, in an earlier conversation, about whether we had a representative sample of, a representative mix of people who have primary homes here or not. And there was a sense that there, that it was pretty close to the actual occurrence. So it was representative.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Let me just mention on, when I say, occasionally I will say things like a certain group is significantly more likely to feel such and such. I almost always mean statistically significantly. We actually run tests to see if there's a statistical significance. So that's why I mentioned that. Okay, so affordable rates. So I mentioned early on that we ask people, what do you value most about the PUD? This kind of question is usually very helpful for us when we look at crosstabs of other questions, right? So we want to know what motivates what people, what do they value? So that's why we ask this. Overwhelmingly, people said affordable electric rates, 64% said that that's what they most value.
Another question.
Yes.
So when you ask that question, is it a multiple choice, or are you actually giving the customer the chance to come up with an answer?
Great question. We did give them options, so we pre-selected things, but they could say something else. So if they wanted, who knows, wonderful commissioners could have been an option or other.
That number, I'm sure, was high.
I'm sure it's in that other 1%.
Yes.
I'm pretty
sure.
It's somewhere out there. And now we're getting into that whole question of what's significant and not.
Not.
Okay. So I'm digging in a little bit deeper to this question. I mentioned that we have crosstabs, and so the staff have reams of data now with crosstabs. I'm going to pull out some that, again, were statistically significant to us. When we look at affordability, now, first of all, across the board, affordability does matter to people. And remember, this question asks you to pick one thing. So if you had to pick one thing, what's it going to be? Overall, affordability was on top, but when we look at the Hispanic and Latino respondents, it is not, it's still number one, but reliability is right up there at 33%. So, and then parks and recreation opportunity also. So you see a little bit more even distribution amongst the Hispanic and Latino respondents. We also saw some differences in geography about how people felt. So, again, reliability might be a little bit more of an issue in one area than another. We also, you know, we were very curious about people who've been here for a while versus people who are relatively new to the area. And we did see so overall with the population, only 5% said parks and recreation was the thing they valued most. But then when you look at those who are relatively new to the area, it was 13% amongst that population. So there are some variations in beliefs here. On the question of aesthetics, so we asked people how concerned they are personally about overhead power lines and service substations and their look or impact on views in the area. 33% were concerned, and then 64% unconcerned. And only 12 of those who were concerned, 12% said that they were very concerned, had that intensity of opinion. So who was more likely to be concerned about aesthetic issues? Again, geography seemed to play a role. The folks in Leavenworth were a little bit more likely to be concerned. People who did not call Chelan County their primary residence were more likely to feel this way. Higher income. We see Chelan Falls and Chelan customers, and then also homeowners. We asked, so you'll see there's this pattern in the questions of how do you feel about something, would you pay, how much would you pay? So here's our question about, well, would you be willing to pay higher rates for electricity if it allowed the conversion of overhead power lines? And we saw that 57% said, no, I'm not willing to pay, only those who directly benefit from conversion should have to pay. And then for the rest, we see, well, 17% said, well, I'll pay if my rate pays for conversions countywide. And 15% said, yes, if they pay for conversions that impact my direct view or in my area. I will point out 17% versus 15%, I mean, it's statistically pretty much a tie. It's going to be within the margin of error. And then 12% just weren't quite sure. I will say overall in this survey, I mean, we do lots of surveys on different topics and frankly, a lot of policy topics. We generally see a fair number of people who have don't know responses to public policy issues where it's just not something they pay attention to. We didn't see that uncertainty on the things that we tested in this survey that we sometimes do.
So on this data, go down to the over to that right-hand box a little bit and walk me through that.
Sure. So these are the folks who were more likely to say, no, only those who directly pay should have to pay. And so overall, 57% said no, but in Chelan and Chelan Falls, it was 66% who said no.
Does that shock anybody?
Well, that could be a result of an inadvertent education.
Yeah, I have to think about that. That's interesting.
And can you actually go down to the next data point?
Sure. So 70%, so the no response, those who were not concerned about aesthetics, so that previous question about their concern around aesthetics, 70% of those who were not concerned about aesthetics said, no, don't want to pay.
So of the 57% that you're referring to, 70% of those folks, is that?
No. Okay. It's 70% overall. So 70% of those who aren't concerned about aesthetics. So most of the people, so if you said, I'm not concerned about aesthetics, you are more likely to say no, only those who directly pay who benefit should pay.
So it's not the 57, it's the 64 on the prior page?
Pardon me?
I was following your math. The 70% of the 57, is it really 70% of the 64 there?
Right. Okay. Right. Exactly. the next, this slide actually shows two questions. So we had two, well, how much would you pay questions? So question 13 was, what if the PUD created something called an aesthetic improvement fund, and that funded the conversion of power lines to underground? And the conversion would take place on community-supported and qualified projects that impact your direct view. So 13 was the direct view. 14 was kind of the same proposition, except it would be across the county. So 13 is in blue, and then 14 is in orange. And so here we've presented the distribution of respondents. People had a scale from 0 to 20. So 32% said, I'm willing to pay nothing. And that was true with the direct view question, with the countywide question. And then we see, you know, your other responses here. The average, the median average for direct view ended up being $4. And this is a month in addition to your monthly power bill. So $4 for the direct view and then $2 for countywide.
It's just interesting. I went back and took a look at that statistic you had that you know, people may be willing to pay $2 a month for something into the future. And if you multiply that out times the meters, times the months, it's $1.2 million a year, and it's about $3 million a mile to go underground. So we could pay for maybe a third of a mile.
We didn't test that.
No. No, I'm sure you didn't, but it's just kind of one of those things you kind of wrestle with as a commissioner, because there are some people who are really adamant, yeah, but just have little idea for scope.
Absolutely.
You know, and so I just think it's just important when you take that and multiply it out.
That's right.
Yeah.
We didn't burden people with too much knowledge in
no.
the survey. It was a
show,
right?
Don't. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Okay, on to the economic development questions. So, again, we wanted to understand familiarity first. So we asked, how familiar are you with the PUD's role in local economic development? Here we saw 28% familiar. And, again, the unsure, I was kind of surprised by that, but there you go. So who was more likely to be familiar? Well, the people who were familiar with the PUD, first of all, were, you would expect that, higher income individuals. And I would say that we do lots of economic development surveys, and so that tends to be true as well. People who've been here longer, and folks who call this their primary home. So then we tested two statements and asked people whether they agree or disagree with these statements. And so these are about economic development. Question 17, or well, let me start with 16. 16 was that the PUD should make investments in infrastructure ahead of need, even if it increases rates. 17 was that the PUD should keep rates low to attract jobs and economic investment. 91% liked that low rates statement, not surprising considering that value statement at the beginning of the survey. And we highlighted the 41% strongly agree. I mean, that is intensity. Imagine if you were someone running for office and you had 41% strongly agree. Like, that's really great. Very few disagree. In fact, so few strongly disagree that we couldn't fit a number on the sliver of the chart there. When it comes to the statement about investing ahead of need, even if it increases rates, 52% agreed overall with that, and we see a little uptick there in the disagree statement, and a little bit more uncertainty. Here are the same two questions again, and again, I wanted to pull out some of the statistically significant crosstabs. So keeping rates low, we saw that mattered more in some specific areas. We see low, not surprisingly, lower income. It's more of a concern. And folks who value the PUD's affordability, it seems like, well, of course, that's who's going to say that. But, you know, we like to scientifically make sure that or see if people's feelings are consistent or not. They're not always consistent, frankly. So on the question or the statement about making investments ahead of need, who was more likely to feel that way? Those who for whom Chelan is not their primary residence, renters were more likely to agree with this, higher income, and newer to the area. Again, we asked the how much would you be willing to pay question. This time the scale changed, so we went from zero to $5 a month in addition to your current bill. And here we see a little bit more of a distribution of responses. So 28% were willing to pay as much as $5 a month more. The average here is expressed by median is $2 a month. So at the end, we asked how if we gave you $10 and you could allocate it across several priority areas, how would you like to split it out? Now, keep in mind that initial question about people's values, we made you pick one. Here we let people spread money out. And here you see affordability does still come out on top of the list, but reliability is right after it. And you see a little more response in some of these other areas as well. Again, we did give people options for these key areas to test. We included visual appeal of utility infrastructure. Since we spent 10 minutes educating people about it, we wanted to see if it would come up on this list. And supportive job creation as well. We wanted to see if that came up. I also have some additional details on demographics if you have questions about it, but I thought I wasn't going to go through those at this point, if that's okay with you.
Quick question, if you don't mind. Back on slide 14.
Yes. Oops.
The do you have that broken down by those that consider Chelan County their primary residence and those that do not?
I do. I don't have it with me at the moment. It wasn't a statistically significant finding, but we could get back to you with data on that.
So any and all demographic information you may have on this slide, I'd be interested in seeing where the dollar amounts fall by category.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can definitely get that for you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions?
I found that to be a very interesting slide.
What's interesting to you about it?
Well, that, and not surprisingly, keep my rates low, and I don't want to pay anything into infrastructure.
Sure.
Let's put that off, you know. Don't fix the plumbing in the house. Let's put that off for a while. Keep my rates low. But, you know, I don't know. I just, this was all very interesting.
Is there an explanation for the large jump at $5? The 28%.
That's it. That is a good question. You know, this is one of the, so let me, I don't have an answer for it. I think it would be something interesting to explore in interviews or a focus group to understand if you give people a range like this, what they would pick. I have a theory that we may have, perhaps we should have given them more options for the range. They might have picked five because there were even more who were willing to pay more than that. For the people for whom economic development was very important, perhaps they were willing to pay more. So they just picked the top end.
Well, I'm just throwing out an observation, and that is that on one of your previous slides, those people whose primary home was Chelan County were more in favor of building out infrastructure in advance of energy demand.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the same people that didn't want rate increases. So that number really sticks out to me. It's like, okay, what category is it? Which is why I was asking
for
demographic information. This, maybe there's an answer there.
Right, right.
Thank you.
Another question from the phone.
Go ahead, Randy.
I slid down to slide 19, which was not covered. And there's an interesting statistic in there that challenges me because the level of education of the respondents, I believe, is far better educated than the general population of Chelan County. I could be wrong there, but that that starts a whole nother conversation. I just point that out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We did not correct data or weight data based on education level. We're very conservative about about any kind of data manipulation after we collect it. And I certainly can give you some statistics about how this relates to the population, but go ahead.
Yeah, my thinking is that some of the results that you got, I find even more surprising based on the educational data that's shown here. And so, you know, I think some of the responses where you saw high numbers might even be higher if it was more reflective of our, what I perceive our population base to be.
Mm-hmm. We will follow up, Commissioner, to get the average data for the county so you can mm-hmm. see those comparisons yep. and you all have them.
I'd be very interested, yes.
And I don't know if it's a data point that's available to us or not, but as our county changes and the population increases, roughly a third of this survey indicates they're retired. Mm-hmm. Retired individuals typically are very sensitive. They're living on a fixed income, so they're watching their costs. I wonder how that reflects with the actual population in the county.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Take that as a follow-up, too.
Thank you. We can look at that. Any additional questions?
Commissioners, any additional questions?
No, just really interesting. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Stuff to think about, process. And...
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just add one thing for the board's sake and give some thought to this and get back to us. But I think, of the six topic areas, we probably have put the least amount of effort into the aesthetics one so far. In part because we had done the survey last year, which indicated by roughly 2-1 margin that people were not interested in paying for aesthetics. This tends to reinforce that view. So at this point, just based on this, I think we're intending to not convene a specific topic team around aesthetics and to take this one as generally supportive of the existing PUD policies. So just ask you to consider that, and if you feel differently about that, let us know.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, again, I find it extremely difficult to estimate the amount of time that our items are going to take. And so we have next up the Holly Street substation update. It's probably a good 20 minutes worth of material. I have checked with the staff. They are available after lunch if you would like, or we could get started now as a way to give you some time to think a little bit about some of it. Or we could go to manager items to make sure that we make best use of the time that's available. So I'm going to leave that call to you as to what your preference would be. What do you think?
I think it has to do with what availability of staff starting and then coming back or whatever would be easiest for staff.
Do you have enough manager items to get us to the noon hour?
Easily.
I think that might be
okay. Great. Let's do that. So we're going to start with
the strategic planning update. Justin Erickson, please present.
Good morning again. Justin Erickson, Managing Director of District Services. Pleased to be before you and give you a brief update on where we're at with strategic planning. And this is a good follow-up to the presentation that you just had as well. So in addition to the random survey that you were just provided the summary of, we, of course, plan on including a survey as part of the district-wide all customer owner mailer and owner's guide, similar to the effort that was conducted 4 or 5 years ago. And so, but as you might imagine, the challenge now is to review the results that we have from the initial survey and prepare, finalize a survey that provides us meaningful information but is not repetitive with that effort. And so, reported to you last time that effort was underway, and we're hoping to finalize that survey over the next week or so, provide you a formal update and presentation at your May 13th meeting, and may also provide you some interim update via email between now and then, just to make sure that we best use your time and make sure that we're on the right track with the survey. That said, if you as you reflect further on the survey that was just completed and presented to you, if you've got thoughts on ways that we could dive deeper or questions that maybe weren't answered that you have a particular interest in, please do let me know, because we do have time to certainly incorporate that into this other effort. To that end, we also plan on convening a public focus group next week. So we've got a draft survey that we're finalizing this week. We want to engage with customer owners next week in a small group setting to make sure that we're on the right track with the questions. We'll provide some context as well, similar to what they would receive in the mail, except they won't have an opportunity to kind of read it on the spot. We'll be providing them with a brief presentation prior to them taking the survey, and then we'll have an open discussion regarding their impressions of the survey and the information that was presented. So this is all in an effort to make sure that we have a end product that's usable for us and for our planning efforts and our five-year business plans. So looking forward to that effort with the public. One of the things that we're also doing is trying to bring a public together for the focus group that maybe doesn't have a strong understanding of the PUD. So someone that has kind of a general, kind of the median understanding of us as an organization in the county, so that we get feedback that's very reflective. So how does this impact the overall time frame? I think one of the initial schedules that you reviewed showed us completing this effort in late summer, and we're still on track with a late summer completion. I believe that's doable. We had initially thought that the survey might be out to the public in early May. It now looks like it will be mid to late May, which carries the survey into mid to late June for the response period. So, but we did have some additional time kind of budgeted in the overall schedule. And I do still believe that we can get this to you in late September. In terms of upcoming presentations, we do still have the presentation scheduled for the Chelan Rotary on May 28th. This minor delay in the survey timing actually works in our favor as well, because there's multiple large community events that occur in mid to late May and into early June. So I actually think that one benefit is that we will be able to engage with the public in real time in this effort at those various community events. And I wanted to conclude with something that I mentioned at your last meeting. That was our effort to engage with youth at Pioneer Middle School. That is still scheduled to occur, and we pushed the date out a little bit as we refine the survey questions and refine the activity that we're going to engage in with the students, since it will be slightly different than the activity with the public as a whole. But so that has been scheduled for May 13th. Are there any questions? All right, thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Next up, I'm going to ask John Stoll and Kelly Boyd to give an update on their topic team.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Kelly and I and the rest of the team had our last meeting, I believe it was on April 18th. It was the third meeting in our three-part series, and we concluded it. Again, that meeting held lots of good feedback and perspectives. We had an opportunity to start the report, and then this was really a refinement and a review and edits and comments along the way. So a successful meeting. We feel the report is now in the kind of the final stages of being put together and will be shortly forthcoming to the commission.
And just to kind of give you an idea of how the report will come to you, we took our strategic question, and it has a number of kind of subcomponents in it, and broke down each one. And the group made a kind of overarching theme that the group could support. But then we had additional perspectives and concerns that are just kind of detailed statements below that. And some of them actually conflict because they, our report, we wanted to reflect the discussion within our group. So while there was overarching agreement on some things, there were definitely areas of concern that different participants wanted to emphasize and didn't all agree on. But we really thought this was a good way to do it because it was reflective of our discussion, reflective of sentiment of a community, and we also thought reflective of the difficulty that the board will have in trying to balance all the different perspectives within the community. So I just want to give you that little preview into what you can expect to see in the report, and we hope to have it to you by end of day tomorrow.
I would like to say a lot of the topic team members commented on the process, and it was they enjoyed it. A lot of credit goes to Kelly. She really did a lot of the heavy lifting. You know, all the team contributed, but, you know, Kelly really kept us on task.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I want to get one more in if we can because it'll free up Mike for the afternoon. So Mike Coleman's going to give you a report on the broadband marketing campaign that we're conducting. And Neil as well. I'm sorry, Neil.
Good morning, Commissioners. Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecom, and with me is...
Neil LaRuzzo, Communications Manager.
So this was a joint effort with Neil's team and my team to launch the marketing campaign, and we wanted to give you a very short update today. Overall, the feedback has been very, very good, particularly on the videos. This also included a rather enthusiastic response from the retail service providers. Localtel in particular has been enthusiastic and used our theme for their billboard, which is now up on Chelan. We viewed that as a positive thing because it reinforces our campaign in its entirety. As usual, there have been, by any time we launch a marketing campaign, it provides a little bit of a forum for folks to air their feelings. The general trend there has been falling into three categories. One is those who currently do not have fiber and they want it. There's another group that they're in areas that are expected to receive the fiber and they simply want it sooner. And then last, there's a group that feels that they have paid for the fiber through their electric bills, and therefore they should have had it a long time ago. So we have responded where appropriate to those comments, and we let them know we're working hard to get the fiber to more neighborhoods. We also direct them to our website and provide them information on what they need to do once construction starts in their neighborhood. I think the thing that was a pleasant surprise to me was that when I looked at the comments on particular editions of the video, the likes on those videos far outweighed the total number of comments. So it wasn't just a negative thing or a grumpy person thing. There was a high percentage of the people that saw it that did respond favorably and liked it. So with that, I'm going to ask Neil then.
Sorry. We had about 50 comments that came in, and what we try to do is we try to bundle those if we see a common theme to respond to those in a general way. If we get specific questions, we try to answer those as well.
To Mike's point in part, I think we, if people are wondering to know when their fiber is coming, we direct them to the website for the yearly plan.
Mm-hmm. So that's worked out well.
I was going to say, the other thing I was going to mention was that I think the distribution of where we had the billboards was great. I don't know if you've seen some of them. There's one right outside our building here. There's one on the way up to Rocky Reach. So the distribution is nice, and I think a lot of people are seeing them. So.
Right. And as always, there's lessons learned. Once we see a billboard in real life, we discover that it doesn't always look exactly like it did in the draft, the mock-up, or the electronic version. We will work on that as we progress. We will not have statistics for this campaign. The first statistics will come in a few weeks. We think it'll take a couple of months to really see the trending out of it and the results out of it. So once we have that in order, we will come back in a couple of months and give you another update. So, any questions?
Just a reminder that essentially what we're trying to do is increase the take rate, which gives us more revenue and makes it easier to do expansion. So there's a connection here to what we're trying to accomplish with some of the concerns that are out there.
A higher take rate cures a lot of problems.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioners, that's it. Other than I did make an error a few minutes ago. I was focused on thinking about the schedule. I did want to call out, even though she's not in the room, Susan Gillen. Susan took on this as an additional duty. We were in the transition where Suzanne Hartman was leaving and Neil was not here yet. We were trying to figure out how to do the survey. This is not in her assigned duties, and she did a marvelous job of working through this, and you see the results in terms of the survey. I think it worked out really well, so I wanted to express some appreciation for the level of effort that she put in.
Thank you.
All right. In this afternoon, if you're comfortable with it, I don't. We haven't seen public show up, and we can take a look this afternoon. If there's not public, I would suggest that we go right to the Holly Street substations because we've got staff that have been sitting here this morning. I'd like to move them through and get them done so they can get back to the stuff that they're working on. You're going to see that their workload is increasing substantially as a result of the acceleration of this process. So we'd like to. Let them do their jobs.
Yeah. Okay. Good. All right. Well, with that being said, let's take a break and be back here at 1 o'clock for the afternoon session. Good afternoon, and welcome to the April 29th, 2019 business session of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission meeting. I'd like to remind everyone to please silence any electronic devices you may have with you today. Welcome all of our get visitors today. We place great value on public input at our meetings, and since these meetings are recorded, if you wish to address any item on the agenda, we ask that you come to the microphone, please state your name and address for the record, and limit your comments to 3 minutes. Commissioners, we have in front of us a consent agenda. What are your wishes?
I move to approve the consent agenda as motion as stated. That includes, we need to go through that.
Well, adding number 14.
I think it's just resolution 14.
14.
Yeah. Okay. Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Do we have any comments? Hearing no discussion. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
And those opposed say nay. The ayes have it. Okay. That motion is carried. Let's move on to the regular agenda. Steve, would you like to present the regular agenda?
I would. I think so. We have two items, and I was just trying to think. I believe that we could do these fairly quickly and then get to the Holly Street issue.
Yes.
So I'm going to try that anyway. We'll try that. So we'll start with Agenda 12, a resolution authorizing amendment number 4 to service agreement SA-TA number 17. -116 with RH2 Engineering Incorporated to provide long-term strategic facilities plan engineering services. Casey, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Casey Hall, project manager. So this resolution amends task authorization service agreement 17116 with RH2 Engineering for site civil design and engineering support for facilities at the Rocky Reach Dam, Rock Island Dam, and the new headquarters service center. The amendment allocates funds for the design work for all three facilities and construction support for Rocky Reach and Rock Island facilities. So RH2 will coordinate directly with TCF Architecture for site civil design for all three strategic facility programs. RH2 frequently works with the district on similar engineering projects. Based on their experience, unique project knowledge, and high degree of direct district coordination that's going to be required for these projects, staff recommends amending SATA 17116 with RH2 and increasing the not-to-exceed amount by $1 million. This new total contract price will be revised to a not-to-exceed amount of $2,195,000.
And I would just note this is within the budget of our strategic plan for facilities. There's nothing that's going on here that would be unusual relative to what's been presented to the board previously.
Commissioners, any comments, questions?
I'm good.
This is Ann.
Yes, Ann.
Whose was the last comment that this falls within the, that this dollar amount falls within the budget? Was that Steve or was that Casey?
That was Steve.
Steve, okay, thanks.
All right. Well, great. Thank you. I guess there will be no comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, and item 13 is a resolution authorizing the general manager to purchase 0.27 acres of land and required site improvements located adjacent to the future Ome substation from GBI Holding Company, a Washington corporation. Vicki Griffin, Jad Rissman will present. You may recall that the overall strategy for addressing that what is a new design standard for substations, Chad presented about a month ago and included some discussion of this issue as well. I would just say that I believe, and they can correct me if I'm wrong, that this is consistent with that presentation.
Correct. So we've been doing quite a bit of work on reevaluating our substation standards in light of all the substations that we're planning on building over the next 5 to 10 years to meet system growth and reliability and other things that are under consideration. As we were acquiring this property, because the opportunity presented itself for the needed substation in this area, we were going after our old standard, which was a one transformer site with the capability to build the two and no mobile. So the idea there was that the two transformers would help back each other up. As we acquired this 1 acre site, 1 acre is what we were looking for previously. As we acquired this, finalized that, we reevaluated our standards and we realized that if we decide longer term, then that we want to load up both of the transformers to full load, and we do that, we don't accommodate space for the mobile substation, we won't be able to do maintenance, or at least we wouldn't be able to do maintenance and maintain service. That's not acceptable. So after that, we decided we need to accommodate in our future stations. So Andy, if you recall, started talking about looking at initially something a little bit closer to 300 feet by 300 feet, a couple of acres, just as a starting point. So we waited until we got through the majority of the design to really understand that we're going to need that space. We're there right now. So we're talking to the adjacent property owner to acquire some additional lands so that we can accommodate this. I put this drawing up on the screen, and for those of you that are on the phone, it's kind of hard to see, but I just wanted to illustrate. This red line is where the property line is now, and this is the fence line here that's going around the substation. This space right here is the space where the mobile will drive into. So the mobile will come down around on the riverside and then come down what would be kind of the downriver side of the station, and it would pull through like this and out. So what we've done is we've shifted the substation north, and that would put this transformer right on the existing property line. So we wouldn't be able to maintain the transformer or get around the other side of the transformer, get a crane in there so that we could lift it off. So we did determine that in order to accommodate the mobile and meet this sort of future standard. So when we started working with the adjacent property owner, this is not the position that we would like to be in the future. We would like to understand that we're acquiring property. I'm sure that would be the direction of the board also. So we understand that this new standard will help us figure out and acquire the site so that we're not going back and trying to acquire additional property. Vicky would be very appreciative of that.
Chad, a question I have is if the mobile needs to be brought in, that comes down this road and curves in, what is the surface of that road and will it, does it have the capacity to handle that?
It does. So this slide is an old aerial.
Okay.
So Stamilt has made significant improvements and designed this for all their shipping traffic to come here. We're going to use the same traffic lane that their semi-trucks are going to use.
Yeah, I'm looking at that going dead of winter. I'm not sure, but that answers that fully, and thank you.
Mm-hmm. So a little bit on the specifics of the resolution or any...
So we worked with the adjacent property owner, which is GBI Holding, and they, of course... being in that line of work, part of the negotiation was that they wanted to do the site preparation that is required for us to be able to build the substation on that site.
Good, Phil.
Yes.
Thank you.
So part of the negotiation was, you know, we'll sell it to you, but only if we can do the site prep. And so we're buying a lot that's already prepared for us to go in and do the work that we have done. We're not contracting on the site on this. It's as if you were buying a spec house. So we're buying an improved lot. The land value of the purchase that we agreed on was $66,000 for the 0.27 acres. And then the site preparation, which was, we had done an in-house estimate of what that was, and their site preparation costs were within 10% of what our estimated cost. Thank you. Estimated cost. So this, the site improvements are $287,377.67. So the total purchase price for the improved site is $348,377.67. We also agreed to pay up to $4,000 for their any professional costs that they might have associated with this. So if they needed legal review or survey review for that, we agreed to pay that. And we've also agreed to put $150,000 in earnest money in with an escrow company. So what that means is they would, if they do work and we don't close, they could recoup, because this has to be closed by June 30th. We're requiring that site improvements be done by then. So if they come in and do the work and then we decide, no, we don't want to do it, they can recoup up to $150,000 of costs that they have already incurred in prepping the site. So the total amount is, as I said, $348,377.67. Is there any questions?
Just a little bit more on the design. So one of the things we wanted to ensure is we had a very good understanding of the quantities of work and things. So our project management worked with the consultant, and we performed a detailed design of the work that was going to be performed. Then our consultant and our in-house civil engineers came up with an estimate. And that's the basis that we used for coming up with the cost for the improvements. I've got up on the screen the existing site. So this is the additional 40 feet. So the work that's required there, right where that property line is, about where that is, there needs to be about a 4-foot retention wall. So this will be a 300 foot by 4 foot tall poured in place retaining wall. And then the removal of all the materials so that, and including those concrete blocks, so that the site could actually be extended. So I showed in this picture, so this additional area right here would be at the same elevation as the existing site. So there's quite a bit of work, I want to say. It was over 1,000 yards of material, significant amount of work that needs to be completed.
Chad?
Yes.
Looking at that piece, just for clarity, where the existing retaining wall is would become our new property line?
There is a slide Do you have a copy of the slide to show that we've got up? So it's
I think so.
Slide number 2, and the slide deck is named OMI Substation Additional Property Acquisition.
Well, I'm looking at one that says topography is of proposed 40-foot acquisition.
That's it. Thank you. So the red line is where the new property line is going to be, the red dash.
Okay.
And you can see where the existing retaining wall is. So that existing retaining wall will be removed.
Okay. Gotcha. Now I've got clarity. That's you've done what I needed. Thank you.
Welcome.
Yeah. Chad, can you maybe indicate where this new retaining wall will be placed?
I don't have a civil design, but from this red line where the new property line is, there's a 2-to-1 slope, I want to say 4 or 5 feet, and then there's the retaining wall. So the retaining wall is going to be a few feet downriver from this new property line.
Thank you.
An additional question on the previous slide that shows the parcel in yellow. And it shows the existing substation in blue?
Yes, we're on it.
Okay. A question about the existing substation. Will that property then become surplus to us?
That is our plan. We will not have a distribution operational need for it.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Okay. I guess not. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Good presentation.
We're ready to go ahead and vote on those measures before we get to the pick up the morning agenda.
Okay. Well, commissioners, we are at that point where we need a motion.
So move to approve Resolution 12 and 13.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Sounds unanimous to me. The ayes have it.
Okay, I'd like to take us back to this morning, and we're going to invite Chad back up along with Lindsay Mons. So this is described as a Holly Street substation update. It's bigger than that, though, because it also addresses the use of that substation, which is targeted towards the new business in town, the Diamond Foundry. So we'll be reviewing actions that do not require any action from the board today, but we are headed towards potentially some actions at the next couple of board meetings.
Yeah. Pretty excited about this project. A little overwhelmed about it, but pretty excited about it. I think it's a great example of private and public collaboration in support of some economic development. So our challenge is we want to try to maintain our very aggressive substation build schedule and also figure out a way to provide capacity for a new customer. So we're going to walk through that a little bit. We're still working on some of the details to try to have it both ways. So we'll get that in front of you. Lindsay Mons is here to talk about the rate structure that we've put in place. So I have on the front screen here that we're trying to get some early notification and provide a certain level of the details. I'll rely a little bit on Eric, who's been instrumental in helping put this together. Thank you for Eric's help to come up with the agreements. So there's going to be 4 total agreements, and we'll get into a little bit more detail on those. 3 of the agreements are going to be related to the relationship that we're going to have with the property owner, in this case, DeMille. And then June 3rd, we're hoping to bring those in front of the board for consideration, the rates contract for the Diamond Foundry. Um, what we're going to try to cover today, a little bit of background on how we got here. Try to describe and illustrate the plan as we know it right now. Where we're at in terms of new information and schedule impacts. So this gets into a little bit more of where we're a bit overwhelmed with trying to deliver a schedule that our customers and our partners, in this case, would like to meet. Talked a little bit about the agreements. We'll get into that in further detail. Again, no action required. So background. Going back to 2015 and the devastating fire of the Sleepy Hollow fire, which caused a lot of damage to Stemilt's facilities, triggered them relocating out into the old station area, which is partly the reason why the previous substation we were talking about building, so they're expanding facilities and things out there. The existing facilities, what did survive in that fire, became available. Meanwhile, the city of Wenatchee started developing long-range plans for their Confluence Parkway. So there began, so the city and the community is looking for additional customers and new loads from us. It looks like new loads, but additional businesses in the area, which is going to require some electrical infrastructure. Not only that, their long-range plans includes condos and a number of mixed use in the area. They have a bit of a live-work play kind of a concept going on with the mixed commercial on this Confluence Parkway. So it's a neat concept going forward. So there's a lot of discussion about how PUD with the utility infrastructure would be there to support this. So as those discussions matured, Diamond Foundry settled on locating in one of Holly Street, one of the Stemilt's facilities there that remained in Holly Street, and they worked out a rental agreement. The issue was that Diamond Foundry wanted more electrical capacity than what we had available and will have available. The existing substation infrastructure was actually planned for load growth in the area. So as I mentioned before, as you all know, and have been helping us through here, is that we've got a pretty aggressive substation plan going forward. So we were kind of in a spot there where we needed to figure out something creative. So Stemilt stepped forward and suggested constructing a substation to be able to serve the Diamond Foundry, and that the capacity of that substation would be dedicated to the Diamond Foundry. On the surface, we really liked that idea because we didn't think it would impact our construction schedule, but we had a number of concerns about connectivity up to our system, and this is an arrangement that we have not pursued before. So something new, something creative, and something that we would need some real tight coordination with, so we were concerned about the staff impact associated with that. But again, it's an exciting proposition because of the economic value. Economic development and the private-public partnership. So let me see if I can illustrate this on a map a little bit here. So try out I'm not as good as Andy at PowerPoint. Let's try this out. So just a little bit of an orientation. This is the North Miller and Holly Street area. I've circled in here PUD refers to as the Holly Street facilities, which includes transmission facilities, fiber optic operations, water wastewater operations, a significant amount of warehousing. The wiremen are housed out of here, so there's a lot of things that are going on in this area that will be reduced quite a bit once the new operational center is built from a personnel standpoint, but this electrical infrastructure will still exist. So we knew that going forward. Oop, went backwards. So originally, the discussions about providing a substation to the Diamond Foundry would actually be located on Stemilt's property that became available after the fire damage. So that we started pursuing that early on in this project, which made quite a bit of sense. We kept running into conflicts with the city's long-term plans, and we started discussing about how the square footage of property available for this longer range plan of this mixed-use area would be less available. So we and also conflicts with some of the city infrastructure. So you might have seen in some of the illustrations that the city's put out, they're planning on an underpass and working on getting funding for the underpass underneath the train tracks, which would be the McKittrick extension. That's a significant part of the infrastructure in this area that you're probably very familiar with their plans there. So we were concerned about how that might conflict with the substation, especially since the underpass hadn't been designed. So we were going to be making assumptions about what the underpass was going to look like, concerned about building something and then having to redo it. So as we got further and further into the design, we started understanding that what might look a little bit more attractive would be to locate the substation where there are existing substation facilities. That just seemed, stepping back, made a lot of sense to the players. We would site existing substation, we would site new substations next to existing substations. So the issue with that is, though, that's PUD property. I think that's about when Eric came in. One other thing I wanted to point out here is, in order to free up where we've got in yellow that it shows the proposed new substation site, which is where this next part of the agreements are showing that this substation is going to be built by Stmilt, there's a significant amount of operational material and a couple of buildings there that need to be relocated. So right now we're working, trying to work through the details and trying to figure out where exactly we would put all of that operational equipment. It doesn't look like fiber is going to be out of the fiber operations and out in the old station area and accommodate that schedule, but we're still working through the details. So it'd be nice if the operational center was available when we had to move all this operational equipment, but it's just not. So there's a timing issue there, and we're going to have to make an interim move. So we're working through the details of that, one of the challenges. Any comments or questions about sort of the plan, the concept here?
I have one curiosity question.
Please.
Where is the Diamond Foundry going to be located here?
Oh, if you can see the McKittrick Street Extension underpass there, that extension, you see the blue line that's to the riverside of the tracks there? That building, the building that's, you can see that's got a white roof that's just north of that blue line, that is the facility that the Diamond Foundry is located in.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Can you help fill me in, just curiosity, the future location of equipment? What equipment?
We're going to talk about this just a little bit, but part of there's a real estate rental exchange that's being contemplated as a part of this, where there's some real estate over on the Stmilt property that we would lease from them for a period of time to move our operational equipment over to. So we would add security and some other things to. It was where the original substation site was being contemplated. So we're talking about a rental of some property in this area that we would use to temporarily store our operational equipment. So not too far from where it was before. We understand there'll be some operational impacts not only getting there, but also it won't be as close to the other facilities. So that's the concept.
And I want to add, you may recall that when we completed the purchase of the port property, we also entered a lease for the IV5 building out at Old Station. I don't think we've informed you. We told you then we were pretty sure we had a use for it, but we didn't know what the use would be. I think we have decided that a good use for that is to move the fiber operations out there. So there's actually some work going to be done out there to rehabilitate the building, get it ready for fiber to come in. That'll take place over the summer, and they'll be moving out there, we think, based on the current schedule, late this summer sometime.
And I would note the equipment that's mentioned here is mobile equipment, things like trailers, temporary cabling, things like that, that the line operations utilizes on a regular basis. So it's not anything permanent, just a temporary storage.
There is two storage buildings that are located in there. They'll have to be abandoned. Most of them are cleaned out by now. We're starting to work on making this ready, and then we'll remove those buildings from the site. So there is a conflict with a couple of smaller buildings. That'll be part of the work that will be Chelan's, on Chelan's plate.
You're talking about the original substation proposed location where it has buildings?
Or? The new location. So I don't know if you can see my cursor here, just adjacent to the existing substation here, which is our North Wenatchee substation.
Okay.
There's two storage buildings that we're using for. One was line building equipment, hot arms, pulleys, tensioners, and things that we kept indoors. So we'll find another location. We're working on another location for those. And all this doesn't really matter. We'll just have to find a temporary location when the new service center comes in, because everything's going out there. Mm-hmm. So, which is part of our challenge, is trying to find some interim operations.
So Chad,
please.
A question for you and Steve. In a previous life, were either of you jugglers? Because it looks like a heck of a juggling act.
That brings us to our next slide. So, Stamilt, being creative, was able to secure a power transformer, which we know is one of the longest lead time and most expensive items of the substation. They were able to secure a substation power transformers, two of them, that had a six-month delivery. So they have since made that order and are expecting two transformers here at or around September 1st. So this really moves up our timeline. And in order to meet that, so the idea here is we would like to have at least the substation facilities constructed far enough along, or Stamilt would like to, so that they can accept these transformers, set them on the pad thing. So we're looking at what are some of the things that the PUD would need to do in order to help them get to that point. And I've got a list of those. Diamond Foundry expects on or about in March of 2020, which is when their power consumption plan ramps up beyond the capabilities of what we currently have as infrastructure. So in the draft agreement that we have with the Diamond Foundry, Lindsay will talk a little bit more about, they're limited to 7 megawatts. So 7 megawatts of capacity is what we have available out in North Wenatchee. They expect to exceed that need in March of 2020, at which time our preference would be that their entire load, not only what goes over the 7 megawatts, but also that 7 megawatts would get transferred over to this new station we've begun to call Holly Street Substation. So we're looking at that and seeing that typically it takes us about 18 months from the time we order a transformer to the time we energize a substation. That's been our last five. That's about how long it takes. So we're trying to figure out how to grow 8 months. Construction would have to begin this summer. There's a significant amount of district work, including we talked about some of that, vacating the property, figuring out the operational impacts that we would have. We're also, to build the substation is one thing, but then to connect it up to Chelan PUD's transmission system, connect up to the distribution, there's a significant amount of oversight and coordination and collaboration that needs to get done in there. So we are telling everybody that we're not sure that we can meet the schedule. We're also wanting to maintain our current schedule of the things that we're trying to get accomplished. Most the one that's on the first on the list is the only substation that we talked about before. We're significantly into design on that station. We expect to be also in construction of that this summer and into this fall. So those two would hit at the same time. So we're working through the details, try to understand what the schedules are like, trying to figure out where we can create some freeboard for us to have a little bit of flexibility, and also trying to identify the areas that we may not be able to meet. Okay.
I want to reinforce this point because I think, so I'll just speak for myself for a moment. I thought this whole idea of, well, we'll have somebody else build substation, that's going to reduce our workload substantially, and public-private partnership really seemed to make sense. The reduction of workload is a lot less than I would have expected, you know, just to be candid about it. As we work through the issues, for example, the idea is they build a substation and then there's a good chance they're going to sell it back to us. Well, they want to make sure that it's going to meet our standards. Well, in order to meet our standards, then we have to have people review all the work that's being done. And it puts us in a not very different position than we would have been if we were building it ourselves. Testing and energization work, that's all stuff that we're going to have to do. Can't turn it over to somebody else to do that. You know, transmission's going to have to, it's going to hook up to our transmission system. So you've got transmission work that's going to have to be done. There's just a substantial amount of work here. And the, I think we are excited about the idea of getting a new business here that's going to create a lot of jobs. And so we're pretty dedicated to doing what we can to try to make this work. There are going to be some trade-offs, and the trade-offs go against some of our goals with respect to trying to improve the reliability of our existing system. And so things like trying to get after the equipment reliability issues that we've got. Chad mentioned Omi Substation, but we've also got work on Bavarian and North Chelan. We were going to be working on South Shore Chelan. These are all things that people are going to get pulled away from in order to be able to move this forward. So one of the things that we're doing is really testing with Stimelt, are you sure that you're on this schedule? Because it has consequences for other things that we're trying to accomplish here. I think we still have more to come on that to make sure that we both are really committed. We could not do this on our own anyway. It will take a huge amount of teamwork with Stimelt in order to be able to pull this off. So we need to make sure that we're aligned and coordinated and working very collaboratively to have any chance of meeting that March 2020 schedule.
We touched on a few of these, so we're on the necessary district activities. So agreements to be developed, that's where Eric and Legal and Bob Davis have come in, put in a significant amount of work and helped us try to figure out how to put together some agreements. Because nothing really starts in earnest until we have authorization to move this whole thing forward. And so crafting up these agreements, getting an understanding what those things mean, and identifying roles and responsibilities is what we've been working on. We'll talk a little bit about those in more detail. Again, I'll just mention that the construction agreements and connection up to our system agreements with MILT, there's three of them. We're targeting bringing those in front of you for consideration on May 13th, and then the Diamond Foundry following that on June 3rd. Schedule approval. So we need to develop new schedules. We need to understand what is expected of us and when. And that's going to be a big part of our capabilities to be able to deliver. Not necessarily because in a vacuum we can do a lot. But because we've got a bunch of competing priorities and things that are going on, the schedule is going to be a very important tool for us to be able to manage what the deliverables are. Design approvals, as we mentioned, ties to the distribution system. If we want to contemplate taking this thing over once it's constructed and operating it into the future, we want to ensure that it's going to be consistent with what we're typically used to having as a substation. So it won't require significant training and things of our crews. So we need to work through those things. We mentioned the relocation of the materials and the Holly Street move. That's going to impact several operating groups. Procurement and construction of transmission, Bowman's group under Kirk's, a significant amount of impact here. As part of the agreement, transmission is going to be responsible for doing the design, construction, and procurement of everything transmission. So transmission is retaining all of that responsibility. Therefore, there's quite a bit of work. We're handling this similar to what would be a line extension, which means that we're not going to do any significant amount of work until you've paid. But in order to receive payment and things, we need to have agreements in place. So a lot of things start with these agreements. construction, inspection, and testing. Steve touched on that. We want to ensure that our crews are in there inspecting it. We have a third eye that's going through every detail of this thing for obvious reasons, operational, safety, and making sure we are going to be able to utilize this equipment to meet the functional requirements. And then, of course, coordination with our customers and contractors. Any questions on that? Those are highlights, but there's a lot that go underneath.
There's a lot going on. Yeah, a lot of coordination.
Yeah, a lot of coordination. And as Steve mentioned, it's starting to feel like that coordination actually is harder than just doing it yourself, right? I don't know if you've ever been and experienced that, but that's what it's starting to feel like. But it is exciting. So so I've mentioned a few times there's three agreements that we've got that we've drafted up and are substantially drafted with Stemilt, and then one with the Diamond Foundry. The three with Stemilt are design and construction, so it covers all of the requirements and roles and responsibilities and expectations around the design and the construction of the facility, connecting it up to the system, and then what happens and what there's a section in there that would allow the PUD to take it over if the PUD finds it acceptable, and it describes what that acceptance process looks like. The second one is the lease agreement, and the lease agreement is, we talked about trading square footage. They're going to trade us square footage on their property for the use of our operational equipment for square footage for them to build a substation. And then a collaboration agreement is how we're going to work together, how we're going to work together to ensure that these goals are met and we understand roles and responsibilities. And then the Diamond Foundry is related to charges. So it's an interesting arrangement here. So the Diamond Foundry is going to be an electrical customer of Chelan PUD, be paying energy rates and demand rates and things, and they're going to actually be served in part by, so the transmission will be Chelan PUD, but the connection, the substation and the distribution or lines from the substation to the Diamond Foundry will be constructed by Stemilt. So it's very interesting.
But I would say it does contemplate approval and transfer of that substation, those facilities, to the district, assuming it meets our criteria for acceptance.
Which is where the collaboration piece comes in. We want to make sure that we do have, in fact, that opportunity, because we want it to be consistent with what we're used to. So a little bit more detail on the Stemilt design and contract, and Eric and Lindsay, please step in if there's anything that you want to add. So the station allocates 28 megawatts to Stemilt's tenants for a term of years based on the asset life. This is somewhere right around 35 years, we're thinking. So this is an important concept. This is actually going to be a double bank, similar to what's going on at OMI substation. This is going to be a double bank substation, 228 MVA transformers, with no capability to put the mobile in there. So we did not design in space. And the reason for that is the Diamond Foundry as a customer expected a certain level of reliability, that in the event there was something that occurred, there would be online capacity available for them to be able to be served from a substation. So we're going to have two substations, two power transformers, each going to be feeding 50% of the load. And in the event that something occurred on one side of those feeds, it would transfer over to the other feed. So that's the concept around providing reliability that the Diamond Foundry requests. This agreement also describes our design standards and design requirements, allocates station construction costs to Stemilt. So Stemilt's responsible for all costs, and costs that the PUD incurs, they are also responsible for those costs. Permitting and procurement is Stemilt's responsibility. It sets conditions where the district could assume ownership and operation following construction. So I think there was some desire of all parties that the electrical system would be owned and operated, especially the medium and high voltage system would be owned and operated by Chelan PUD. That made a lot of sense to everybody. So I want to make sure there's that capability to transfer over if it meets certain conditions that are laid out in the agreement. And then it establishes charges for proportional share of operating costs if the district assumes ownership. So recovery figures out Lindsay's crafted out, and we put ways to recover Chelan's costs. So it'll be a pass through. The lease agreement, mentioned this a little bit, but this is an exchange of property for a certain term. The district's lease extends to the completion of the new service center, so this would allow us to be able to store these materials and equipment and things, the backhoes and trucks and equipment, on Stamilt's property until the service center was done, and then we would relocate. Again, Stamilt would construct the substation. Property boundary description, so we would carve out this specific piece of property. That piece of property would be described and permitted for, be described in a boundary line adjustment. We would carve that out separately, so that's part of the process that we'll be working through, is defining out that part of property. We also held on to enough property to be able to expand our existing North Wenatchee substation, so we're not pinning ourselves. We do have real estate there to expand our existing facilities if we need additional electrical capacity in the area, so we wanted to reserve that opportunity. And then the lease agreement with Stamilt on Chelan Pewdie's property would terminate if the district took over operations and ownership of the substation once constructed. The collaboration agreement really just lays out how we're going to review and provide comment back on their designs and their construction to inform them that they're moving in a direction that's consistent with the district's standards or not. So it's really just how we're going to work together to understand that we're building something that we'd be willing to take over.
So as Chad's mentioned, the previous three agreements that would be with Stamilt, the fourth agreement, which is the Diamond Foundry's large load contract, would be directly with the Diamond Foundry, as they are our electrical service customer. And this will be the district's first over 5 average megawatt retail service contract. So we're plowing new ground with this, developing new model contracts that should make this process a whole lot faster next time around, we hope. But for this one, we are targeting June 3rd to come back to the board, hopefully one final time. We have a meeting this week with the Diamond Foundry to tie up the loose ends that are left on that contract, and I will plan to be back at the next board meeting to go over those if anything's changed, and in more detail as well. The first time we talked about the Diamond Foundry in this level of detail was back on January 21st, so this slide should look slightly familiar to that presentation. So contract elements that are currently contemplated would be a term for 14 years. It's kind of an odd number there, but that's to match the remaining term of their lease with Stamilt. They have been there for about a year now doing improvements to the property. If you drive by it, it looks quite nice from the outside. I don't think any of us have seen the inside. They've got some very proprietary technology going on, but I understand it's just from other research, it's very similar to the semiconductor clean room sort of environment. So they've been working on that the past year. But so this contract would be for the remaining 14 years, up to 7 average megawatts through our North Wenatchee station there until such time the substation is complete, when that full load up to 19 megawatts would transfer over to the new substation. The rates that are contemplated in the contract would be basically Schedule 35, so our basic charge on Schedule 35 and a bulk of the demand and energy charge at Schedule 35 as well. However, the first about 1.6, it's hard to say about when you've got that many numbers, 1.675 megawatts of demand at Schedule 3, and that's approximately reflective of what Stamilt was using at that facility prior to the fire. And we have been talking with the Diamond Foundry for over a year now, so it was close to after that fire took place, so we took that as a historical load at the site and are utilizing that within this contract for Schedule 3. Going up one line to the energy charge, assuming a 95% load factor is how we got that 1.5 0.91 average megawatts for energy service. We do mention in here stream flow risk charge. This is something that we've been talking about. We talked about back in January, just as a potential within that contract or within Schedule 35 in the future, and just letting the Diamond Foundry know that that could be coming. However, that would go through the normal board rate process, so just as more of an awareness for the Diamond Foundry than anything here. The Schedule 4 charges that were approved back in January, which was the point of talking about this, energy capacity charge, load imbalance charge, load following, demand exceedance, and excess energy charge would all be applicable in some way, shape, or form within this contract. Some of them, like the energy capacity and load following, would apply when the load reaches 5 megawatts and greater. The load imbalance charge is slightly different in that we give them a band of 3 megawatts of variability, and anything over that, we request they contact the district if something is going to change. And if those communications break down, at that point, a charge like the load imbalance would apply. So for the most part, all of these charges we expect to have a very minimal impact on the monthly bills of the customer if they operate in the way that they've told us they plan to. So that's a whole lot of information. If there are any questions, I can take those. But like I mentioned, I will plan to be back at the next board meeting to talk some more about this. And we can go into depth in any of these areas that the board would like more information.
So that's the May 13th. Board meeting, and then we'll
May 13th, yeah. And then if all goes well at that point, provide a copy of that contract for the board and public review, of course, with the any proprietary or confidential operating information from the Diamond Foundry redacted, but available for public review in terms of rates and everything else.
I think the key, just to make sure this is absolutely clear, are lines 4 and 5. That's where the vast majority of the charge is going to come, is in the energy and delivery charge. And essentially what's happening is a small fraction of the total, based on what current usage is, will be at the existing lower rate, but the majority will be at the high density load rate.
So, for next steps from here, I've talked through several of these already. Chad and maybe myself will be back talking about some milk contracts, requesting approval of authority for Steve to initiate, or what's the right word, delegate approval of those contracts. And then as well on May 13th, doing that final staff update on the Diamond Foundry with a request for approval June 3rd, pending any other questions or recommendations.
Good. Commissioners, any questions, comments?
Yeah.
Chad, I have one question, and maybe you can just circle back. It was maybe a misunderstanding, but you mentioned that there's no provisions being made for a mobile sub.
Is that right?
Correct.
Can you explain that for me again, please?
So the mobile substation, we advertise something less than a 24-hour install time, so that's about how long it takes us to put in. In reality, we've been a little bit closer to 10. Miller Substation, which is the last emergency where we actually put that in, I think that took us 8. But it's close by. It wasn't tied up. So if we had to remove it from a different location and things, so when we presented those numbers to the Diamond Foundry, that was an unacceptable time frame. So that's when we started talking about actually having the capability to have online capacity.
So while that station is built with 2 transformers, only one would be fully utilized, yeah, on a firm load type basis. Yeah.
So availability of transformers. Sometimes they're really hard to get, and it takes a long time. Just so we have works going to get those delivered appropriately.
Yeah, so that's part of Stamilt's responsibility, and okay. Stamilt has the ability to do different things than we do.
Yeah.
And they were able to secure some transformers in pretty short order. So.
Nice.
So I think that's driving the schedule right now. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we expect to be back, again, depending on how these conversations go, expect to be back at the next board meeting.
Okay. There we go.
Okay, we are back to manager items now, and I want to invite Ron Slabaugh to come up for a couple items.
Well, thank you. How are you, Ron?
Hi, Ron.
How are you?
Good.
Good. I'm going to wait for Commissioner McKenna to come back.
No, I think you should go ahead.
Sure. Okay. So the first thing we have here is a postcard that we plan on mailing out to our customers tomorrow, all of our water customers, to advise them that we have relatively high pressure within our water system and some of their responsibilities and what they can do to minimize any potential damage to their plumbing related to the high water pressure that we have. Surprisingly, our average pressure is about 105 PSI. There's a uniform plumbing code requirement that buildings have a pressure reducing valve installed if service pressure exceeds 80 PSI. And we exceed 80 PSI to about 75% of our customers. So although this is clearly stipulated within our service regulations that it is the customer's responsibility, we don't have a really good mechanism for advising customers that that service regulation exists. So this is a way that we're going to advise everybody at once. And then on a go-forward basis, whenever we have new customers or changes, say a customer that has electric service in Wenatchee, or they move within Wenatchee to the PUD water service area, we're coming up with a way right now to be able to send them postcards also. So on a go-forward basis, every existing and every future water customer will get this message.
It's a valuable message, and I'm pleased to see you sending it out in such a broad-based mailer. We discovered the hard way that we have high water pressure, and consequently, as a result of that, have a reduction valve and also have gauges before and after. So we can see what it is coming in and going out. It really does help to have one in terms of the reduction.
Yeah, appreciate the feedback.
Yeah.
And we did include some language in here also, not for customers not only to have one installed, but check it every so often, check the pressure, because they do fail. And we're aware of some of them out there that have lasted for 20-plus years and others that only last for 3 or 4. Exactly what influences how long they last, I have no idea. But yeah. Just want the customers to be aware. Because we do have some places like Mr. Stoll's home where the service pressure exceeds 200 PSI.
Wow.
We do that intentionally.
For that's right.
Yeah, it is.
Wait, you don't need to buy a pressure washer then, do you?
No. Okay.
Yeah, that's great.
Nothing else on that. And the other one we wanted to talk about was Chesson Water District. Okay. Want to rewind just a little bit because we have a public power benefit program where we asked customers back in 2015 to submit ideas to us. And one of them that came from Leavenworth and Cashmere in Chelan County was that we studied the feasibility of regionalizing water and wastewater services up the Wenatchee River. We conducted that study in, 2017 and 18, and came to the conclusion that as a whole, it just wasn't feasible. The option that we looked at, several different ones, but primarily it was the PUD taking over the city's water and sewer systems. And we hired a financial consultant, looked at it several different ways, and it simply wouldn't pencil out. But Chesson Water District came to the table also, and they were part of that study. And the consultant concluded at a high level that there could be something there, that it might be feasible, primarily because Chelan PUD has a pretty large water system, and Chesson Water District is 240 connections to Chelan PUD's over 6,000. That at a high level, it might be feasible. So Chesson Water District wanted to continue looking at that. And back last November, so November of 18, we attended a proposal. They had a PowerPoint presentation, and it was Steve, John, Kelly, and myself that attended. And they presented why they would like to have the PUD take over their system and some of their requests associated with that transaction. One thing's a little bit different with their system. They have a water right, And how much is there, we're not really sure, but it could have some excess value to it. So they would like to have seen some consideration for that value. We're not as optimistic there that there is as much water right available as they are, and really it has to go through a process. And many of the commissioners here recall when PUD acquired that water right, or the regional water, PUD being a member, acquired that water right from Pioneer Water Users Association. It was a multi-year process, and there wasn't any money that changed hands or any value determined until Ecology had the final letter on how much water was actually available. So that's part of it. And essentially, we put together a response to their proposal, went out to them in a letter in February, and where I just identified some sideboards that if they wanted to move forward, you know, the sideboards under which we would move forward. And one of those is if they really needed to reach out to their customers, because we hadn't heard anything from their customers. We just heard from their three board members that this is something that they wanted to see. So April 10th was the first public meeting that they held. And I feel that they did a pretty good job inviting their ratepayers to attend. They had, I believe it was advertised in the paper, on the radio, on their webpage. I attended that. It was in the evening out in the Peshawson Memorial Hall. There was, I think, 18 of us that signed the sign-in sheet. And so I was one, so that's 17 customers, give or take. And overall, people were still in support of moving ahead. The two fresh fruit packers out there, the general managers for Bluebird and Peshawson, or Bluebird and Peshawson High up, were there, and overwhelming support from them. Ron Gonzalez from Bluebird felt did a pretty good job of describing that. He feels that the existing commission's done a pretty good job up until now, but with that E. coli hit they had on their source water back in, 2017? And the more recent fire out there and their response to that, he feels on a go-forward basis that the PUD might be better suited. He went on to say great things about us and our water service for his facility down here across from the event center. He says that he never has to concern himself about the quality or the quantity of the water down there and is, in his position there. He doesn't want to have to worry about that. And on a go-forward basis, he would like to have that certainty out at Peshawson as well. And the community members overall seem pretty supportive, too. There was one sideboard that we listed, which is they need another well. Their existing wells are in, they're deteriorating, and they need a well for both capacity, well, reliability, that's two, and the third, I suppose, would be to perfect their water right. And that's going to cost some money, which they don't have. So we identified that we would need them to pay for the cost of that well, less any grant funding received. Fortunately, from Department of Health, there's a fair amount of grant money that can be made available for system acquisitions like this. The Department of Health is very in favor of PUDs and water districts taking on these smaller systems because they generally have the resources to manage them better than the smaller boards do. But nonetheless, in order to not negatively impact our existing customers, we feel the existing Peshawson ratepayers would need to pay for the cost of that well. And, of course, we need to perform a more thorough evaluation than what was completed within that water-wastewater regionalization study just to make sure that if we do indeed take on this system, that we can do so without adversely impacting our customers going forward. So where we're at now, Peshawson is going to have two more at their next two scheduled public meetings. Actually, there are two in May. They're going to engage the public, again, ask for some additional feedback. I've agreed to attend both of those meetings as well. And then they're going to want to move ahead with further discussions with us on, you know, can we make this a go or not. I think that brings us up to the current from 2015 until now. Anything else to add, Steve?
Just that, in general, this acquisition, I would say, is not strategically important to us, but it is potentially a good community service. And so, again, we struggle with the challenge of it's a good thing to do, but it impacts our existing workload, too, and the things that we need to do to carry out. You know, Ron's not sitting around twiddling his thumbs. He's quite busy with a lot of things going on, including engaging on second source issues, which is a really big issue for us. So we're prepared to sit down and engage here, but we'll have to work through and be sure and confident that this is really something that community wants, and also try to work through the timelines for when it can happen relative to the other activities that we need to carry out.
And Ron, you said there were 200? How many customers?
About 240.
240, and if only 17 showed up at the initial. I personally don't think that's a very representative number. We need more of a representation of those folks that will be impacted by this decision. So, and I know you said there's more meetings coming up, so I'd like to be kept informed on how many people show up for those meetings.
Yeah, my guess is there'll be even less in the future, but we'll see. Yeah. Simply because they did a pretty good job advertising it, and we got 18.
Yeah. I've encouraged Ron to ask the Possession Water District Board if they would consider taking a vote on this, because they are the elected officials representing that community. It would be a way of displaying the importance of that community of proceeding down this path, knowing what are the key considerations for us. And if we're not saying that they have to vote to agree to our terms necessarily, but they shouldn't walk into this without a good understanding that these are the things that are going to be important to us in this negotiation. And if that is still a sound basis for moving forward, it'd be good to know that from in a fashion that is a clear representation from the elected officials that their commitment to this process.
Right. Yeah. Good.
Anything else?
Okay.
Cool.
Good. Thanks, Ron.
Thanks, Ron.
Thank you.
That's it for the manager items for today.
Okay. Commissioners, we have a proposed motion. Would anyone like to make that motion?
So I would move to set a special meeting on May 29th, 2019 at 1 p.m. at Confluence Technology Center, 285 Technology Center Way, Wenatchee, for the purpose of holding a tri-commission meeting.
Second.
So it's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor saying aye.
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 Those against?
Aye.
Aye. Those against say nay, and the ayes have it. Are there any other commission items to be discussed at this time? Hearing none, let's move on to delegation of action items.
So we've got a few. There was one you'd ask for a list of the safety meetings, get the commissioners. Rebecca, I believe, mailed that out. This is after the board workshop, actually. We have some things that we're following up on. The dashboard measures that we talked about, we'll be working on. We've already had a discussion at the senior team level. We'll be planning to bring that back to you around the end of Q2 to see whether it's in the right ballpark for what you were looking for. And Eric and I are working on the risk areas and to potentially make modifications to the governance policies. So we've got some more work to do on that. And then Rebecca did research whether the search tool in BoardEffect can be narrowed to a date range. Sounds like that's not available under the current tool, so we'll keep looking to see if it becomes available. We had an action item from the last board meeting, which was Kirk Hudson was asked to provide a map of generating units to the commission showing what's on and what's not on. I think he provided that over lunch.
Yeah, got right. That. Very helpful.
Yeah, thank you.
Exactly what I was looking for.
And actually that's it for action items.
Okay. And action items for today.
Got a couple. So a couple from the survey will provide some demographic breakdown of respondents in relation to that question number 18 about building infrastructure in advance of need. I'm also going to provide a comparison to the respondents' education levels to the county in general. And then finally, Ron Slaball has got an action item just to let commissioners know how many
PWD customers attend the next two meetings regarding a potential acquisition.
Okay.
Miss anything?
No, I think that was it.
Okay, so do we have any public comment? I don't see any public in the audience. Any matters of general business that may come before the commission? Hearing none. We need an executive. We do not.
We do not need an executive session.
We do not need an executive session. We'll write this date down.
Don't sound so excited.
Holy wow. Cow. All right. All right. Well, I guess we're ready to just close this meeting and another record close. Look at the time.
Yeah.
I'm getting good at this.
Right.
So I guess that's it. We are adjourned.